Hey, Spittin' Chiclets listeners, you can find every episode on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Buddy, welcome to episode 307 of Spittin' Chiclets, presented by Pink Whitney, from our friends at New Amsterdam Vodka, here in the Barstool Sports Podcast family. What is up, gang? Hopefully everyone's doing well out there. Thank you so much for the great feedback on last week's episode. Everybody really enjoyed Yablonski and Playfair. We got an old school fighter and a guy on a very popular show in Canada, so everybody really appreciated that. For week three of our November interview series, we have three-time Stanley Cup winner Justin Williams, as well as Canada's Mr. D himself, comedian and actor Jerry D. Some good stuff coming.
Hey guys, it's Big Cat, and Fight Week is here. Rough and Rowdy 24 invades Clarksburg, West Virginia this Friday night, April 19th at 8 p.m. Eastern. For the first time since Rough and Rowdy 1, every single fight will be a brand new brawler, and we found the wildest hillbillies the holler has to offer. Order now to enjoy 20 amateur matchups with no headgear, plus our live ring girl contest after the final bell. These country roads are being paved with blood and grit and balls. Join me and Dave on the call for Rough and Rowdy 24 tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern. Witness all the chaos with pay-per-view replay available all weekend long on buyrnr.com. That's buyrnr.com.
All right, now we're going to liven the place up a little. It's time for the one and only Justin Williams. Well, we're very excited to bring you our next guest, one of the most clutch players of the last 20 years. This guy played 19 NHL seasons, totaled over 1,400 games, regular season and playoffs. He won the Stanley Cup once with Carolina and twice with the Kings, and he was the Conn Smythe winner in 2014. And, of course, in nine game sevens, he won eight of them while putting up 15 points. It's an honor and a pleasure to welcome to the podcast the legend himself, Justin Williams.
Hi, gents.
What a fucking intro, Willie.
Oh, my God.
Hey, all right, you left out the part they never spent a minute in the Always Hungry League, just straight National League, right from the end of junior.
Had that in the questions, but yeah.
Oh, sorry, I took one of his questions.
That's the only one RA had written down.
Yeah.
Way to go, Whit. Oh, man. So actually, let's see you start off, RA. You probably got a bunch there.
Yeah, I was going to say, so what are you just coming from coaching? Is that your kids' team or a different team?
No, coaching my kids' team. So I found myself just kind of dabbling a little bit in the past couple of years. And then when, you know, you see your kid out there and he's getting coached by, you know, some random dad and he's trying to tell him something, I'm like, I got to get involved here. I got to get in. I got to get on the ice. And
the dad wants you in as bad as anyone. He's like, come on, I need a little help here, bud.
Yeah. So I just said, you know what, I might as well get into this. And I've really, really, really come to enjoy it. I coach my son's team. And then unfortunately, my daughter is taking a little bit of a backseat, but she plays hockey as well. And I try and coach there as much as possible too.
You're looking a little jacked too. You're on the Rob Brind'Amour coaching regime, taking fucking needles in your ass too.
You know, he makes all his coaches work out before, you know, practices.
Does he?
And stuff. And, well, I don't know if he makes them, but I think he kind of guilts them into it. So they gotta, you're in there. If you get there early enough, they're all on the bike and working out. So
you'll see no chubby men running the PK with Rod the Bod Brind'Amour.
Yeah, no way.
All kidding aside, Rod the Bod, I mean, you win a Stanley Cup with him. Legendary picture, the way he raised the cup, the scream he gave, and then you play for him. So what was it like, I mean, coming back? It must be a little different having shared such a special experience and then, you know, being coached by a guy.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like if you're lucky enough to have that evolution of the hockey player, like you break into the league and then you get a little bit older and then you're still playing and then all of a sudden – your friends that you played with, they become scouts, then they become GMs, and you're just like, oh my gosh, like what is happening here? So a lot of the guys I know are coaches in the league now, and obviously Rod is one of them, and I thought maybe initially it might be a little awkward. I don't know why I thought that, but it was far from it. You know, it just picked up right where we left off. I can go in the room and talk about anything I want. The guys are like, hey, go get a day off. I'm like, all right, we'll see. I'll try. So it's just a lot easier to have that relationship. And obviously we share the same, I think, attitude and expectations that we want. And it was pretty easy, to be honest.
Were you guys always trying to one-up each other when you were on the same team? Didn't you have a little healthy competition going?
Who, Roddy and I?
Yeah.
Not really. I mean, he was my centerman. I think I was sheltered a little bit, right? I mean, that guy was so good offensively and defensively. I played like 98% of my shifts that year. It didn't matter. PP, PK, 5-on-5. When I played in Carolina, he was with me all the time and made me look good, I think.
I want to know what your record is going in asking for days off. Were you 10 for 10? Did you ever get a Manute Bol? That was not
right when the door opens, turn around.
Yeah, fuck off. Just do a push up here before you leave the office too.
You can kind of get a feel when you get in the door whether or not you think you should probably ask for one or not, or you just chicken out and just leave the room. So it was just so easy. It was honestly so easy being a player when he was a coach. It was a piece of cake.
It's funny you mentioned like the whole thought and experience of like playing with guys, and then all of a sudden like you keep going and they're becoming the scouts and becoming the coaches, and it hits you like, I've been doing this a long time, but it probably makes it easier. You have so many connections in the hockey world. Have you even thought at all about what you want to do next, or is it just wait and see, just kind of enjoy retirement for now?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how, you did it, but I met RA
in a dark alley and smoked crack with him, and then we started Chiclets.
So anyway, mine, I don't think it's going to be like that.
Real love story.
But I mean, listen, I think I've got some time here to kind of just do my own thing and kind of figure out what I want to do when I grow up. Right now, I'm just enjoying being home. I'm enjoying coaching the kids. They're 12 and 9. It's a great age. Yeah. I don't have to answer to anybody if I want to go golfing like 4 or 5 days of the week. I don't have to answer to anybody, and I love that. I don't have to be anywhere right now, and I'm enjoying living life right now. And I'm sure maybe at one point I'll get sick of it and move on to whatever heck I want to do. But as of right now, I'm just happy just being here.
So your son's 12, you say, so that, I mean, that means he got the dream where he has a lot of years where he remembers being like, a son of an NHLer, and he's going into the room. I think it was so cool. The guys I play with who had kids old enough to understand like what their dad was doing. He must have loved Ovi. Has he been around ever since he was kind of old enough and gotten into the game?
Yeah, he was. And ever since, I mean, he was born in Carolina, and then, a couple months later, I got traded to LA. So he spent the first seven and a half years in LA, then moved over to Washington. And I mean, a son of an NHLer, they if they're involved in hockey and they want to be in hockey, that's great. But it just gives them that opportunity that not many kids have. And, yeah. And I think he's very appreciative of what he's been able to do. And I think as you go along as a hockey player and you have kids, you want them to be able to see what dad does. You have this big house and these things, and a lot of these kids, they grow up, they're like, how did we get this? But my son and my daughter, they actually know daddy worked. He was, a good hockey player. And, that's how we got what we have. And, it was great to have him around. Fortunately, all the teams I went on, loved having kids in the dressing room, and he was palling around. And I mean, what an experience for a kid, I tell you.
Talking about teams you've been on, we always like to go back to the beginning of guys' careers. You played a couple of years as juniors. Now, I heard you're a big crossword puzzle guy, which I just said to Biz, that pretty much makes you a savant of the NHL. Obviously a smart guy. How close were you going to college instead of juniors?
Well, it was different for me in the fact that, like, I wasn't, like, I was drafted in the first round, but, like, I had the chances of me being drafted to the first round were very slim the year before, because
it was a quick rise.
2 years, you were playing in the North American League some games, weren't you?
I was. So my first year, I got drafted by the Plymouth Whalers, which are, they're not even there anymore. I think they're in Flint. So I got drafted in the sixth round in the OHL, which, listen, it's not great. They don't expect much of you as a sixth rounder. And Actually, Peter DeBoer was my coach. And, you know, that first year I was just, you know, I was a late bloomer. And I obviously had a lot to learn as well. And he was my coach and he was hard on me, but I think he gave me kind of exactly what I needed. And halfway through the year, they're like, all right, this isn't working out. So they sent me down to the NAHL there. I played for the CompuWare Ambassadors, you know, for like a month or so. They kind of got called back up and it was interesting. And you know, the next year I had a great year and I was drafted in the first round. So it happened quick for me.
So now it's so different. I mean, because like social media, we always bring this up, but kids would be so upset if they're OHL and they get sent down the first year. Did you even like, were you rattled by that? Did you realize, all right, something's got to change here? Or were you just like, all right, I'm going to just go play good down there? Like, what was the approach being that young and seeing guys that also are 16 playing in the O or 17 and you're kind of not there the whole time?
Yeah, I think a lot of the way kids are now, you know, some of them expect a lot before they've earned it. And, you know, I got sent down there and I was like, okay, I was still confident in myself. I still felt I shouldn't have been sent down. I felt I needed to get more opportunity, but, you know, I went down there and played very well. You know, and I was always a guy that was like, I'm going to show you type dude, you know, not like, oh, mom, dad, look at this guy. It's being so unfair. Right. I was always like, no, I'm going to show this guy and I'm going to prove him wrong. And, you know, that's kind of been my attitude since I was, you know, a kid and, you know, a little spunky, you know, confident in myself, but, you know, went down there and then you know, got called back up and, you know, got an opportunity later to play and rolled with it.
Does that attitude and kind of approach to life and hockey come from like your father? Like what was your beginning into the game? Was he a player? He got you in? I know you had uncle, you had like great uncles I was reading that played in the NHL. Is that true? I don't know if you ever met them.
I mean,
but
RA might think I had a great uncle, Jerry Toppizzini, who played for the Bruins in the 50s. He might
have
done a little bit of research on it, but yeah.
RA wrote the guy a letter when he was like 30.
Yeah, I had another great uncle, the brother, Zelio Toppizzini, who played for the Providence Reds. And I think he was named the player of the century, if I'm not mistaken. So, I mean, he's, you know, we've got some bloodline in there, but
yeah, ancestry.com. That's how you found out.
Yeah. So I just loved hockey. I was a, you know, kid from just outside Toronto, an hour outside Toronto from Coburg. And I loved the game and, I didn't know where it would take me. I just know I wanted to play it.
So you finally do break in the NHL, the 2000-2001 Flyers. When you get in the locker room, 36-year-old Rick Tocchet, his mere presence just scared the shit out of you.
Goodness.
Yeah, I mean that guy especially. I was a little intimidated, right? You're 18 years old. You come to the room. You got Mark Recchi, John LeClair over here. You got, you know, I'm sandwiched right between. I know you guys had Kevin Stevens on the podcast lately. He was right next to me in the stall. And Tockett's right next to me and Keith Jones is there and Chris Therrien's chirping from the other way. It was like overload for me. And
it sounds like an 80s movie and you were in the league.
Young blood.
Yeah. And you know already, right? The way he talks, like you can hear him from six rooms away. He's so loud. You know, he's like, rah, 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 right? Like, I don't know what he's saying, but it's funny because it's the way he talks, right? But I mean, Rick talking, I mean, that guy took me everywhere. He's like, hey, let's go to dinner. He's like, okay. I'm like, okay. All right. Hey, let's, you know, come over. We're going to go train in LA for three months. Let's go. And I'm like, okay. Hey, let's go to the bar. Okay. I'm only 20, but, it's fine. We'll get you in. You know, it was just, he took me everywhere and I have so much respect for what he did for me, bringing me in and, there are countless other guys in that team as well that have done it, but him especially, I just have a little soft spot.
Wasn't Keith Primo your first roommate?
He was, Biz, yeah. This was before, right? I mean, I don't know if you guys are old enough to remember, but like, well, some of you are, but when you got your own room in the NHL, it was a huge accomplishment.
600
right?
games it took you when I got in the league.
Yeah,
it was 600 games at first. They've moved it now to out of your entry level contract. 600 games you had to play.
I think everyone gets one now.
No, not entry level contracts.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
That'll be the next 600 games.
The newest CBA.
Fleury was with, I think, Mark Bergevin. He was like, take my bags upstairs, kid. Bergevin had a roommate.
So how are you with Keith Primo? Had he not played 600 games yet?
So he had not played 600 games yet.
Oh my God.
He's got, you know, four kids. Like, he's 30 years old or 29 years old. I'm breaking into the league. I'm rooming with Keith Primo. And I'm like, kind of like one of his kids, kind of, right? You know, just, I was just a pain in the ass roommate. Like, we would sometimes, I'd be like that little kid, you know, we get those double beds next to each other, and I'd just be kind of like throwing stuff at him, just like throw a pillow at him or something, and then throw one of my, you know, French fries I just ordered from room service. I'd be throwing it over. He goes, throw one more and I'm coming over there. And I, of course, threw another one. And off he comes, and we start wrestling in the room. He pinned me in about 4 seconds, but I don't know. We had a few of those, and it was just fun. I was just being me and being annoying.
He was actually sick that year too, your first year. And that was one of his best years in the league. And I think you must have seen this guy when he was going. He was a beast.
Yeah. I mean, him and Mark Recchi that year were on the same line. And those guys, I know you know Rex. I mean, that guy just nonstop. His wheels are like, his feet are like the Roadrunner, right? They never stop moving.
Oh. And when he gets like, he'll dump it in if he's frustrated, go like hammer someone. The bench just gets fired up. The year that you guys won the cup in Carolina, he had been in Pittsburgh, and you could just tell he was just disgusted with losing. He just won his whole career pretty much. And finally he got out of there and made such a difference with that team. I'm sure everyone thinks that watched them play, you know, obviously you guys play together. He was just such a fucking legend. And yeah. I told this story. I was called up and I was in the locker room. I was the loud guy in the minors. And I get into the NHL. It's Mario and Recchi, Lyle Odelein. And I'm like, come on, wrecking ball. Let's fucking go. Orpik looked over and he's like, dude, shut up. Call him the wrecking ball.
But did the older guys love it?
They probably kind of loved it. And they probably were kind of like, shut up. It was different then. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, maybe deep down they loved it, but they wouldn't let me know that they did.
It probably mattered on your play. If you were snapping it to them tape to tape, they're fine. If you're not, then they're like, shut the fuck up, kid, or get sent down.
Well, the last two seasons that you were in Philly, you had Ken Hitchcock. We've heard a ton of stories about him on the show over the years. You ever have a good FU match with him?
I didn't have the balls to do that. I mean, guys would do it on the bench. Like JR would just turn around and tell him to F off. I was, you know, like, have my stick just like this, like what's going to happen, you know? And you know, nothing happened. And I think he kind of like Hitch was kind of, I feel like he kind of liked the fact that the guys were in it together. Like if everyone all hated him, then he's fine with that. As long as the whole team is in unison with it, you know, everyone's together, then that's fine. Hate the coach. That's fine. And you know, he pressed buttons and I didn't think he liked me obviously earlier on in my career. I mean, I think I was, you know, I was a little arrogant, I think, in my younger age. And I think a lot of players maybe in that, you know, in the Philly room would probably say it too. But, you know, I wasn't disrespectful of any court. I was just kind of just, I didn't know any better. Right. So I'd be.
And it's what got you. It's what got you there.
I'd be sitting in the room with my feet up or something. And they'd be like, can I get you anything, Willie? I'm like, no, I'm good. I'm good. Thanks. And they'd be like, all right, see you later. You know, and just roll their eyes at me. I didn't know. Right. And now I know, and I certainly learned quickly there.
So then they end up trading you Carolina. Was your attitude a reason you got traded, like this behavior, or was it other stuff?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, I was in, I think my fourth year there, 4.5 years there. And it was at the trade deadline, and I think they just needed a defenseman. They got, you know, Danny Markov for a playoff run, and they're like, the way it was back then, it was a little bit different, right? I mean, you know, guys were traded at the deadline. They didn't really think about the future, right? They didn't really do that back then. They said, we need to win now. We need to do this. And, you know, they, you know, traded me. And usually when you get traded, it's a wake-up call saying, oh, careful. One team gave up on you. It's, you know, it's time to really buckle down here and earn your keep or you're going to be out of the league. So, you know, that first trade, I think for a lot of guys, a wake-up call. And fortunately for me, going to a team that really wanted me and really put me in a great situation to succeed was obviously what I needed.
Yeah, obviously a 2006 Cup run. I'd say to Witt, I've said it on the show before, I think it's maybe the most underrated Cup final of the expansion era. I think because it came off the lockout, it had Edmonton in Carolina. It wasn't New York, L.A. It wasn't as flashy. But I wanted to go to Game 7. You guys had a 3-1 series lead. Edmonton comes back, forces a Game 7. You know, have a very veteran-heavy team. Who says what before that Game 7, and what do they say?
So it was interesting because, you know, usually before the game, you know, the coach comes in, you know, not before the game, sorry, pre-game skate, or no, sorry, this is before the game. Sorry, my mind's a long time ago. So before the game, the coach usually comes in like an hour and a half.
Three cups ago.
Yeah. So he comes in like an hour and a half before, and they you know, they get you going, they get you riled up a little bit, give you a couple tidbits on what to do, and that's that. And, you know, Roddy had put up his meeting 5 minutes before coach's meeting. So coach saw that and then just scraped off his meeting, being like, you don't have to hear from me anymore. If Roddy's going to say something, that's going to be it. So, you know, Roddy just stepped up and said, boys, we've been waiting our whole lives for this. And, you know, obviously said some other things, but he didn't talk much when he was a player. So him doing that and just kind of, you know, putting things into perspective for us that here it is, you know, you waited your whole life for this. And we had so many guys who were older who never won on that team. If you look back and just see it. And I think you can tell by the emotion on the ice after that game, that what that game meant, obviously to me, but even more so the older guys who were mid 30s and had never won. And it was pretty emotional. And you could tell by Roddy's emotion after he lifted the cup.
One of them being Ray Whitney on that team. And he told me the story about when he had all the casseroles. Was that it? The casseroles before the game, and it was during the anthem. And then sure enough, he thought it was a fart. Right before puck drop, with this guy ends up shitting his pants. No, it might have been a playoff game, but he ends up shitting his pants, and he had to line up and take that first shift because you can't change your name's already on the score sheet. But you were on the team at that time, were you not?
I was. I mean, that guy's he just added character in any team he was on, right? I mean, he was so funny, that guy. But I do remember that story. You know him, and he says it, you know. Sometimes you can like listen to stories, but this guy was a storyteller, right? You could just, he told it and you would just start laughing halfway through and not stop.
I've been on golf trips with him. I was going to just totally agree with that. Like, he's an amazing storyteller. He drags you in. You end up just in the way he tells it, he changes his voices and shit. He's awesome. But that series, I know obviously there's a speech before Game 7, Brendan Moore talks, but it was kind of crazy. I mean, you guys could close out. You could win the cup at home. You lose. You go back to Edmonton. You kind of get spanked. That flight home, was it quiet? Was it awkward? I remember Andre Waugh in Tampa told me same thing. They're flying home back to Tampa when they lost to Calgary. And I think he pulled a prank just to try to loosen the boys up. I didn't know if it was different for you.
It was pretty quiet. I think it was pretty quiet in the fact that we got absolutely shit kicked in Game 6. I mean, it was 4-0 and we didn't stand a chance. I mean, I felt like they had like 7 players on the ice that game. We're just getting run over, and it was like, whoa, what just happened here is totally different from the first 6 games. So, you know, we had to regroup, obviously. It was a pretty quiet flight back. I mean, it's always going to be quiet when you lose, but especially going back with an opportunity to win. You know, you have your families all coming in, flying in for this, and you got all this hoopla, and then, you know, you kind of get it shoved right in your face, and it's tough to get back, but the boys did it.
Yeah, I wonder about Cam Ward, too. I mean, you mentioned all the veterans on the team. I mean, you said Wizard, you got Doug Waite, Rod, Recky, Wesley, all these old guys, and you got a 21-year-old kid in net who's probably shitting his pants a little bit in that flight home. But I want to mention, you get the empty netter in Game 7. I mean, you put a bow on that series. Like, you could see the exuberation in your face, but take us through that as it happened.
Yeah, I mean, to this day, with all the players that were on the bench, I was like, what was I doing out there? What is he putting me out there? But Peter Laviolette, he put me out. You know, it was the first unit PK. I was out there on PP. I was given every opportunity to succeed there. And really helped me with my confidence, you know, of being an everyday NHLer and being an impact NHL player. So I was on the ice there, and Eric Staal was out there, and Rod Brindamore was out there. And, you know, you don't really think about scoring an empty net. You don't want to get the puck out of your zone, right? Just don't get in the zone. Just get it out of here. And fortunately for us, you know, broken play. And then all of a sudden, all I had was open ice ahead of me. And I think Stahl gave me the puck, and I just skated as fast as I could because I saw Pronger trying to catch me, and that guy's got a long stick. So I just did the best I could to get down there as close as I could to the net and then put it in. You know, you don't want to make a boob at that point.
In fairness, I do want to say I think there's many guys, at least in the regular season, that want to score when they get it on their stick with the empty net. Everyone wants those cookies, those easy ones. But our boy Commodore's on that team, just comedy. I've known him forever, and I can't imagine playing with him how much fun that was. I mean, it made a huge difference for you guys.
Yeah, I mean, I still use some of his lingo, even just talking to guys, you know, just
deep his boys. Thing is like,
his thing, when anything doesn't go right, he's just like, take a pound, right? He's like, oh, Whit, you missed that putt? Take a pound. You know, it's just, he is a hell of a character. And, you know, a guy I talk to a lot, but it's, you know, a guy I don't talk to very much, but we keep in touch. You know, just there's certain guys you just always have that special place. You just want to keep talking to them and keep the communication lines open. And, you know, I got to get on the course with him again.
Has that a whole team ever been together again? Or probably not, right?
They had a 10-year anniversary of them winning the cup, obviously 4 years ago. My math is right, right, Grinnelli? Is that right?
Grinnelli doesn't know.
Correct.
He's fucking...
He dropped out of high school to do this podcast.
So all the guys were back there, but there were only a few of us still playing. I think myself, Cam Ward, and I think Andrew Ladd were the only ones still playing. So everyone else got together and had a hell of a party, but the rest of us were still playing.
I was going to ask a Debbie Downer question about that. You guys had created that culture there. All of a sudden, you know, the building was packed. And then it dwindled off. And I mean, to the point where, I mean, there was, you know, talks of potentially the team moving and it, you know, got to pretty much the basement. Were you following after that? Were you disappointed to see it kind of dwindled to what it did?
Yeah. I mean, Carolina's kind of always had like a little, ever since then, really. And ever since then, given me an opportunity, they always got like a special little place. Right. So you always look, you know, to see, you know, it's like having like an ex-girlfriend. You're like, how's she doing? Not too good though, right? Like, she's not dating anyone better looking than me, is she? You know? So,
ding,
I
ding,
mean,
ding.
You keep tabs on her.
I win.
But I don't know. It was too bad, you know, for a long time there. But I think we're on the right track now.
Is that the only time in NHL history? Am I wrong here that Maurice got fired for Laviolette, and then Laviolette got fired for Maurice? Was that what happened there?
I believe that's correct, yes.
That's probably never happened again, RA. You may know that one. Like, where a coach that was fired by one guy then is hired when the other guy's fired?
The only guy I can think of is Billy Martin in baseball. That might have happened too, but not so much in hockey. But you didn't have Maurice until the way out, right? You had Laviolette from the get-go, right?
Yeah, I had Lavi from the get-go, and then he got fired, and then, yeah, Maurice came in. It was like it was so weird. It was like a revolving door. It's like Laviolette said bye, and then like 3 seconds later, they like pass each other, and out comes the new coach. It's, hey, guys, I'm your new coach. It was kind of awkward, but, I mean, that's the NHL. You know, it's kind of weird.
Did you know that was coming, that trade? When you went over to L.A., you figured you were probably getting moved?
I didn't know, because usually injured players don't get traded.
Yeah, I know, that's true.
I had a broken wrist at the time. I had a really tough stretch of injuries, like really tough, that were just kind of weighing on me. And you know, I was actually watching Trade Center. It's kind of like when Trade Center just started, and then all of a sudden, a couple years later, like all the insiders know the trades before the players know, right? I mean, it's just the way it is now. And I was watching TV, and they're like, all right, we have a trade. It looks like Justin Williams is going somewhere, the three-way trade with Edmonton and LA. We'll fill you in when we get back from commercial break. I was like,
oh, no, you're like, fucking Edmonton.
Oh, my God. You're like, wait a minute.
No.
So they came back, and that's how I found out. They said, all right, three-way trade. Mm-hmm. I'm going to LA. Patrick O'Sullivan's gone. I think
Edmonton. Yeah.
Eric Cole's coming back to Carolina, and that was that.
You talk about your injuries and stretch of bad luck. I mean, you played so many games and have battled, like, two torn ACLs. I mean, a broken hand. I've just read a bunch of different things. And then the only reason I really bring this up is because one injury, unfortunately, it happened to you, but it kind of changed the way hockey testing has their preseason workouts. You tore your Achilles in a testing exercise, and ever since then, I think teams have certainly gone a little less crazy on testing guys.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, the day before camp, you know how veterans can usually do their some of their testing before the regular people come in.
Pigeons.
So we were doing our
training camp numbers.
Yeah. So we were doing our testing, and it was the beep test. You know, they do it in basketball. It's like kind of suicides, like in basketball. So you go to one end and you hear a beep, and then you go to the other end and you hear a beep. And the moment you can't keep up with the beep anymore, you got to bow out, and, the rest of the guys are running. So I don't know why I was still running, but there was only two guys left, myself and Ray Whitney, and we're running. It's like level 13. I'm like, what am I doing? But
that's
I don't want to stop. And I just planted, turned, and it was just a pop. And I didn't really know what it was. I thought it was an air bubble in my shoe. I think a lot of guys I've talked to have said kind of the same thing. Like, they didn't quite know. And then I just couldn't walk. And a couple of days later, having the surgery. So it was tough.
That's what you get trying to keep up with Ray.
I know. Those guys, those short little stubby legs. I can't believe he was still running.
But then you get to LA. I mean, I'm sure you got over the trade pretty quick once you get settled in, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was different. I mean, wow, going there and then going to Manhattan Beach. And I remember when I got traded, I had to call my wife because she was teaching, and I said, "Hon, we got traded to LA," and she had just we'd just been there a few years, bought a new house, that whole thing, right? And I was like, don't worry, I'm going to find us a great house and it's going to be awesome. So I went down there, and I'm sure you guys have been down there, Biz. I'm sure you've been down to Manhattan Beach, and you go look, and I'm like,
no, I've never heard of it.
I'm going to go find a cool house. So I'm walking the Strand there, and I had no idea. I'm walking the Strand and I'm picking out little pamphlets they have for like open houses and stuff like that. And I'm like, oh, this is nice. So they don't have the prices on there. And then I realized why they don't have the prices on there, because I called and asked about this house, and they're like, oh yeah, it's $8.5 million. I was like, all right, hon, we might not be living on the beach.
Shit.
I got us this unreal one bedroom in El Segundo, though. You're going to love it. You're going to absolutely love it. I'm going to take a town car in every day to the rink, and we're going to love here, and we're going to be nice. Oh my goodness.
Kobe was living in like Beverly Hills, I think.
Unreal.
So the first few years in LA, I mean, it's certainly not like the team that ended up like, winning a Stanley Cup. You got to experience those 2 years prior, the buildup and like these studs coming in when Kopitar and Doughty just came in and just dominated right away. Like, how did it feel kind of getting to that team, becoming a guy who's everyone's looking up to? You're a Stanley Cup champ. You're getting older. I mean, what was it like there, at least at the beginning?
Yeah, it was awkward. It was an awkward team. It was just a really awkward makeup of guys. And obviously they were rebuilding, and Dean Lombardi was like his first or second year there. So he was, slowly trying to build what his vision was. And I think as a GM, right, it doesn't happen quickly, right? When you have a vision, it's like a couple years out. You need some work to get to there. And eventually he got his team and he got his guys there that he trusted and guys that he, wanted to roll with. And we slowly just creeped up, lost in the first round, lost in the second round, and then just kind of just got better and better every year.
When Daryl came in, is that what you guys needed? I know Terry Murray was a coach before that, I believe. And I mean, you probably have a million Sutter stories, I would imagine. And he was just kind of a hard ass. And I know that you guys at some point locked him out of the room or a team meeting anyway. So let's get into that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone who's played with and probably for Daryl has some stories. I think maybe every Sutter brother, I don't know all of them, but I mean, Daryl was in your face, but he was kind of like a little condescending in the fact that he's like, what, you don't want to play tonight? Is that what's going on? Oh, you don't want to play. All right, that's fine. And, it was like, no, I do want to play. Like, put me out there, you know? And he's like, nah, forget about it, you know? So I remember this one time when he was in, we were in Minnesota and we were playing a game in whatever, February or something, or maybe March, and, you know, kind of getting close to playoff time. And after the first period we came in, I think we were tied or maybe even winning. And I heard him coming in and he was like mumbling behind me. And I was like, oh boy, something's going on here. So if you know the Minnesota room, the coach's office is right next to the dressing room. And you can't see them, but, you know, they're right there. They can hear everything we're saying, right? So everything's all quiet. You know, we didn't have a great period. You know, we weren't terrible. We weren't great. And all of a sudden, you know, those aluminum folding chairs, one of them comes flying right out of the room and hammers the bathroom stall. And we're like, whoa, what the hell was that? And all of a sudden the coaches start flying out of there. All the assistant coaches and everybody, they start running out of there, and another chair comes flying out and he's just losing his mind. And the coaches don't know where to go, right? Because they're like, whoa, where do we go? Right. So they were just hanging in the dressing room with us while he was losing his marbles. And, you know, we're looking at it and we can't see him, right? So we're kind of giggling like this, like, what's he doing in there? And, you know, eventually it calmed down. He left the room and then he came back and he kept everybody on their toes. I tell you, it didn't matter if you were an assistant coach, you know, a player, a scout. I mean, this guy was when it was game day, it is game day. And, you know, I remember with Billy Ranford, he'd come in for his team meetings and Billy would have his hands in his pocket. And Sutter would just, he goes, Billy, what the hell are your hands in your pockets doing? Get ready. It's game day. And Billy would be like, I don't know what to do with my hands now. Right. I mean, what movie is that? All right. I'm sure, you know,
Ricky Bobby, Talladega Nights.
Yeah. Yeah. So he, every time in the meeting then he'd have his hands like kind of like here or whatever, just not in his pockets. So he was awesome.
Clenched
in
fists, awesome, ready to fucking go.
He was an awesome coach. Exactly what we needed.
We want to ask about 19-year-old Drew Doughty. What was he like in the room? We heard some stories about him.
Yeah, I mean, he was, yeah. Has he been on the podcast?
We haven't had him on yet.
I think I've texted him a few times. No answer back.
Richie told us, though, that he slept through the gold medal game in Vancouver, so we knew he was an animal.
Yeah, he'd be an absolute treat to have on, because he says whatever, right? And that's just Dewey. That's kind of like whatever, baseball, Manny being Manny. It's just like Dewey being Dewey, right? It's just kind of what he is. And I remember a story, like we went to a golf tournament once and he was, you know that golfer Kevin Na?
Yeah, walks in every putt.
Yeah, so they had, you know, the board there and they'd be walking around and he'd look and he goes, why is that guy's name not available? And we're like, Dewey is his last name. And it was his name.
Fucking right. But can he play hockey, though? I tell you that.
Fucking that guy wheel around an arena.
Now, that first cup second for you, but first in L.A., Jonathan Quick, absolutely incredible, that performance he put on that year. Was that the best goalie performance you've ever seen, either as a teammate or even an opponent?
Best performance I've ever seen. I mean, like when they didn't even have to announce the Conn Smythe winner. It was just like, just give it to him. Like there was nobody else he could have gone to. He was so good. And he was so dialed, not one game that you're, you know, a little bit suspect of him. Like, oh, he doesn't have it tonight. He was just on. And the things that he could do, he has his own style, right? And it's just what he does, his competitiveness. And he was a great friend and what an unbelievable run he's had. And I still think he has more left in the tank, but I mean, what a year, what a playoff he had there.
That was one of the most dominating run through the Stanley Cup playoffs. I mean, you guys lost what, four games, two before the finals and then two in the finals.
And they went on three benders while doing it.
Of course they did. The Los Angeles Kings running through the whole league.
Yeah, every series we were up 3-0 in every single series we played. So it was the only kind of pressure we had. Well, listen, playoffs, we had pressure. You had pressure every game. But, like, the only, like, time it was like, whoa, let's go here, was when we were up 3-0 in the finals and New Jersey won the next two games.
But it's New Jersey.
And you're like, boys, let's buckle up here and finish this off. So it was an interesting run, totally different from the 2014.
Well, I was just going to ask you about that one. You guys go down 3-0 in the first round of the Sharks. Like, what? Like, are our guys booking flights to Cabo? Like, let's be honest here.
I don't know. I certainly wasn't, but I mean, it was interesting. I can't say anything more than that. They had knocked us out of the playoffs, I think, the year before that, maybe even the year before that as well. I can't remember, but they kind of had our number a little bit. We just, I don't know. It was just, we won one game at a time. I know it's such a cliche thing, but we won one game. And then after you win one game, you're like, let's win another one. And then the pressure's back on them, right? And I felt after we won the fifth game, we were down 3-2. We won the fifth game back in San Jose, like 4-0 or something. And then it was like we kind of felt the thoughts that they had. And we kind of felt that this was possible. And it certainly was. And it kind of springboarded us to you know, some series wins.
Yeah, you guys outscored 18-5 in that comeback. I mean, it wasn't like any of those games were particularly close. Now, obviously, 2014, that's when you won the Conn Smythe Award. I mean, obviously, you were a worthy recipient, but were you a little bit surprised you won? Because usually the guy with the most points gets it, or the guy with the most goals. I mean, you did lead the league in assists that playoffs, but were you surprised they didn't call one of your teammates?
I was actually very shocked. I mean, listen, Justin Williams is not
a
sexy
surprise.
Name. You know, it's
that's
not
a nice thing to have under your name, though. Call.
It's not a sexy name. It's not a Jonathan Quick. It's not a Jeff Carter, Marion Gaborik, Anze Kopitar, Drew Doughty. Like, those guys are, you know, in like another league. You know, I'm just Justin Williams. It's not a sexy name. So yeah, was I shocked? Yeah, absolutely. I was shocked. And I think that's kind of what kind of hit me at the time. If you see like the camera, I was like, my eyes were welling up like, oh my God, for real. And you know, just the response you got from your teammates and them coming over to give you a hug and congratulate. It was just the emotions that playoff run were the most up and down I'd ever felt. And what an ending to it.
Well, you made the name sexy now, I'd say, no.
All right, thinks it's sexy, I guess.
Moving right along.
I didn't even get the fucking joke. I'm still trying to register it in my brain.
It wasn't even a joke. He was just like, you know, by now his name is fucking pretty sexy in the world of hockey. I'm assuming that's what the joke was. I got it.
It changed to Mr. Game 7, though.
Oh,
did that all
you
start?
You don't like that, I heard. That.
I avoided that in the intro.
Did that start with the empty netter? Is that where it all began? Was that the kind of the luck you needed to get the ball rolling?
I don't think it was that run. That it was 2014. It was that run. We just won a bunch of game sevens. We won three of them that year. And, you know, fortunately I did well in those games, and that's when it kind of started. And, you know, that name kind of came, I don't know who came up with
it. Does it make you cringe?
Well, I don't know about you guys, but I don't like talking about myself. I don't like seeing myself on TV. I don't like hearing interviews with I don't like seeing myself and I don't know. I just don't like it. It makes me uncomfortable.
All right. Let's talk about the side of it. So every game seven that you went into, did you try to do it like the last one, as far as superstition's concerned, or were you just like, no, going into it, playing with the house's money at this point, and then they kept coming?
Yeah. I mean, you just got to get into like a mode, right? You know, just somewhere in your brain where you feel comfortable in the fact that, you know, you won't be denied. And I want to be the guy. And you keep telling yourself, I want to be the guy. I want to be the guy. Not, oh man, I don't want to make a mistake here. I don't want to turn this. I don't want to throw a pizza in the middle. Like, not that. You can't get those feelings in your head. You just got to be, no, I'm going to be a difference maker. I'm going to do this. I'm not waiting for anybody else. And that's kind of what the attitude I had. And, you know, I think that kind of helped me.
Then you scored the huge goal game one. I mean, I know you guys won the series 4-1, but did it almost feel like, not that you won the series then, but that seemed like such a close matchup that whoever won game one could have easily won that series, because the Rangers threw some punches that series.
Yeah, they were a great team, and it was done in five games, but, you know, sometimes
it didn't feel like it. No. I don't know if that makes sense. Like the games are all close. It
doesn't tell the whole story, absolutely. I think, you know, you can look at sometimes maybe when teams get swept, you're like, they got swept? What happened there? Like, it sometimes it doesn't happen. And we won three games in overtime. So game one, game two, and game five. So we won all those games in overtime. So obviously they could have gone either way. But, I mean, it was, yeah, I mean, the whole Cinderella thing was, you know, just capped off with that series win.
So after L.A., you go to Washington for 2 years. What was the key factor in you deciding to go there? They had the best shot at a cup, money. What were the factors that went into that?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of – I mean, I wanted to stay in L.A. I really did. I think sometimes, you know, players and agents and general managers, sometimes the communication just isn't there, right? You know, and it's good sometimes to I guess just say, hey, my agent's dealing with it, you know, I'll be okay. And sometimes you gotta step in and be like, No, I wanna stay here, let's make this work. And you know, at some point we just moved on from LA and I was like, all right, let me try and find the best fit. And Washington was one of the teams that was like really into it early. You know, they weren't offering the most amount of money, but at that point you're just like, I can't go back to a crappy team. That's not fun. And you know, Washington just came, and the ability to play with, you know, a Kuznetsov or a Backstrom, you're like, okay, sign me up. I mean, I don't have to do much, just put my stick on the ice. So that's how I kind of got there.
When you get to Washington, you must have started seeing right away how special a group of guys that is and how much talent there is and why they're winning President's Trophies. But then the success isn't there in the playoffs. You've now have three Stanley Cups. You know exactly what it takes to win at the highest level. Were you able to see things right away that team had that they really probably weren't going to be able to get it done if that stuff didn't change?
I think so. I think sometimes it takes guys different at different points in their careers. They realize what they have to do to win. Some of them come in and just think it's going to be easy. And some of them get, you know, come in and get a Stanley Cup their first couple of years and don't ever get back. But, you know, some guys like the guys in Washington, like Ovi, like, I mean, this guy is not even close, like the best goal scorer I've ever seen in my life, but he turned to another level, and he was an all around player when they won that Stanley Cup. He did everything. Like, he was blocking shots. He was back checking. Like, he did everything that a leader should do. And obviously scoring goals, he does that too. But I think he just took it to another level there. Obviously a lot of guys in that team did. But when he did that, you know, I was really proud of them. Unfortunately, I lost them by a year. You know, I'd already moved to Carolina, and I was obviously I'm jealous, but I was just super, super proud of them. And it was pretty much the only time I was openly rooting for another team to win the Stanley Cup. I usually just turn it off and be like, oh, why do they have to give it out this year? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God.
Well, I was going to say,
try watching. Go ahead, Biz.
Was it a case of like at the time that you played with him, he necessarily wasn't willing to do all those other things?
I don't know if that's exactly what it is, but there were instances where you were like, well, maybe he didn't give it all he had.
Little
there.
Flamingo.
And that
the guys on the bus are like, did you see Ovi tonight? Not his best.
But I mean, when you're that good and have the abilities that he does and being such a great guy too, such a fun guy to be around, just to see him like get it. Like he just got it. And you know, them winning was obviously a memory he's never going to forget.
You're probably pissed off all those parties they were having all over D.C., all over the internet. That was like one of the first or second teams where that became a thing, you know, a sort of a virtual celebration with the fans. But I want to ask Barry Trotz, he was your coach there for 2 years. What was it like having him for your coach?
Yeah, he was great. I mean, Barry and I still have a real good relationship. We're in the bubble there and in Toronto, they're running into each other almost all the time. And He's just a great guy. Like, there's no other way around it. Obviously, he expects a lot, and he should, and he demands a lot. But he just has a different way of doing it, and he's got a great coaching staff that surrounds him. And I'm just not shocked by how successful his teams are and how good they are. He's able to get a lot out of the guys, and I think most importantly, like, you know, from him to his family, like, they're all just great, great people. And I was another guy I was just super happy for. A guy had been in the league a long time, coached a lot of games, and for him to get that, I mean, that's all they wanted there. When I first got traded there, I mean, that's all they talked about. And, you know, for them to get it, it's so rewarding.
When you go back to Carolina, I know I'm hopping over here, the storm surge. You're an old school guy. You come in the league, you're in the room with Rick Tocchet, and all of a sudden, like, they want you to do some fucking celebration on the ice after wins. Were you down with that right away?
Whose idea was it?
So it was the owner, wasn't it?
Yeah, so it was... They had talked over the breath.
The breath before the explanation.
You don't even need to answer the question, though.
No, we were talking over the summer about, you know, Carolina, and we needed to do something, right, to get ourselves, like, talked about. Like, Carolina, you're always going to be the little brother. I get it. Like, it's Carolina. Like, nobody's talking about Carolina. So for us to become relevant and bring these fans back who hadn't had playoff hockey in, like, 9 years, I mean, it was getting kind of dull. And, you know, I am an old school guy, but they were like, let's try something else. Let's do a little something after the game. And that was kind of it. They were like, you got it? I was like, all right, let's come up with something. And we did something the first day. We ran into the boards, and then, you know, we did it again. Then we kind of got bored with that. I was like, I don't want to run against the boards. So we said, all right, let's do something else. And we just kept coming up with new ideas, and we kind of got into it. We were like, all right, this is actually kind of fun now. And we just kind of rolled with it. We didn't want to do the same thing over and over because we kind of got bored with it. But it was just something that kind of grew and grew and grew. And I'm sure it's something like your podcast, right? You just don't know how it's going to end. You just kind of do it. And then you're like, wow, people seem to really enjoy it, or people seem to really hate it. But either way, we're doing what we do.
And then this mutant biz shows up out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Right. And then Evander Holyfield KOs Jordan Martin up. You're like, what the heck just happened?
Hey, what ones were your ideas?
We had, like, eventually after the first little while, like, we had, like, a crew. We'd sit there and, like, eat lunch, like, pregame meal together, and be like, all right, what do we got going on tonight? And we'd just come up with ideas, and then we'd have, you know, fans, you know, start to come in and on Twitter and give us ideas. But I don't know, we just came up with them. Well, you know, hey, it's March Madness night, let's bring out a basketball hoop. Or, you know, hey, it's it's Super Bowl night, let's throw the football around. You know, and to be able to have the freedom to do whatever the heck we wanted, it's kind of cool.
And it made the fans love it. Who was the first person in the media to shit on you guys? Like Don Cherry?
I don't know. I think anyone, any old school guy.
I think I might have.
Yeah, I mean, whatever, right? I mean, the thing is, we don't hear much media in Carolina. So people are like, oh, they're perfect. Talking bad. We're like, oh, well, we didn't hear about it. So, you know, we go to the rink, we leave, and that's it. We have three media members in the room, and they don't ask us about it. And we're just like, okay, that's it. See you later. So
this is great.
Carolina was also the first time you wore the C, correct, on your jersey, captain? Did that change anything with you, Willie? Like, did you just keep doing what you're doing? You're already an established veteran at that point.
Yeah, it was a weird situation, like, the year before. Like, I think, I don't know if they've ever had co-captains before, like, in my, I can't remember. You guys ever remember having their co-captains before?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, you do?
I remember.
Do you
that.
Remember, like, another team that ever had it? Like, not just one.
Co-captains. Fuck, there was another team that I can't
remember. Minnesota think of. Did, like, alternating captains for years.
Minnesota, somebody else I'm not thinking of did it.
Yeah. So it was kind of weird. They gave Justin Falk and Jordan Staal, they're like, all right, you're going to be the home captain, you're going to be the away captain. And it was kind of like, it was like an endorsement of nobody, right? It was just like, all right, we don't really think you're the guy, but we're not really sure you're the guy, but let's just give it to both of you. And you're let's see how it goes. And it was just an awkward thing. I mean, those guys are both great leaders, and either one of them would have been a great pick, but just to pick nobody instead of somebody, it was weird. So the next year, you know, Roddy came in and he gave me the captaincy, and it was a little, you know, to talk to
set in stone.
Justin and Jordan and be like, you know, we do this together, you know, this isn't anything to do with anything else. And I mean, Jordan now has become such a great leader on that team. It's unbelievable. And he wears that C awesome. And I'm proud of the way he's certainly this year, the way he's done it.
Did they get A's when you took the C from them?
Yes.
Yeah. There you go. So you're not getting dropped completely off the legit line. You're getting a letter on your sweater.
Yeah.
In retirement, there's so many things you can do. We chatted earlier about, like, what do you want to do? But I know one thing, you're a golf nut. And if people at home, how do you know this guy's a golf nut? Well, I heard he played golf. I heard he loves golf. Well, he's actually doing this interview with his what looks like first-class TrackMan simulator in his basement with the 18th hole of Pebble Beach lit up. So give us your insight into your golf game, how much you like to play. Will that be a big part of retirement? Are you looking to continue to get better, or are you more just a golf when you can fuck around guy?
No, I mean, I think any guy who has like a simulator like this in the room, they got a problem, right? And I have a problem. Like, I've got a tripod set up that I'm doing on this video that I take and I look at my swing and I dissect it. I mean, I got a problem. I don't know what it is.
All down the YouTube rabbit hole, just trying to change shit at fucking 4 a.m. in the morning. Honey, come to bed. Fuck off. I'm working on the backswing.
Yeah. I mean, I put other players next to me and be like, why can't I look like that? And it's just, you got to swing your swing. But I love golf and I'm going to be doing it for a long time.
It's the best. It's so, I mean, I maybe didn't come off as a competitive person when I played hockey, but I am super competitive. And so golf, it's like it gives me ability to, with my shit body, with my horrible ankles and feet, to still be competitive at like one thing in life. So I just love it. I said to these guys before you came on, or when you were figuring out your audio, look at this simulator. This thing's filthy. And Grinnelli's like, you got to get one of those. Wait, I said, I really don't though. Because like you said, I have a problem. I have a legit problem. I have a disease. It's called being obsessed with the game of golf. And if I have a setup at home where I can have this world-class simulator, like I would just not sleep. I would be in it. It for me, I think it would be too much. It would push me over the edge. I'd OD.
You know, there's numbers up here on the screen. I've had to find out what every single one of these numbers mean and what's expected of these numbers. I don't know. I don't know. At some point, maybe I'll get sick of it, but I don't know. I always just want to get better.
Is that like the, you mentioned the name of the company with, like, is that the top of the line one?
TrackMan's the best, I think. I think they're like 25K-ish right around there. But then you got to set up like the screen he's got. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty big. They're pretty big money. I mean, all the pro golfers have them. They bring them out to the range when they practice and they see their numbers and they see what they want their numbers to be. And like, it's very turned into a very, I guess, analytical thing. But with golf, it's like if you can get the same result from figuring out the numbers and the impact and the swing plane, you could really use it to benefit yourself. I don't know if you agree with that description of TrackMan, Willie.
No, that's. I don't know if we're just the only ones who are like feeding off of each other right now in this conversation. But
we are. All of a sudden, we just started looking in each other's eyes, and there was like a connection. And
the entire time you were talking, I was wondering how the fuck do you putt? Is there like a little? Is there like a little green off to the side of the mat?
Putting does not. There's nothing for TrackMan for putting, I don't think. But putting is like a different, like galaxy. Not even a different planet. That's its own galaxy where the toys they have for a metronome, like for your putting speed and pace, and it should have a beep on the backswing and the foreswing. Jesus. And dude, yeah, it's fucking game of science.
I want to say Tiger got like this new top of the line one where you can actually put any green of these top courses they play where the hole, it'll shift. Am I right here?
No, I would believe it. I would believe it.
I want to say I saw it on his Instagram. But yeah, it's crazy what they're doing for the world of golf.
No, I think that's right, Chris.
I want to go back to DC for a minute. That picture day you guys had, you come out with this like basically Afro hair all over the place. Did that rub anybody the wrong way or ruffle any feathers?
I don't know. That was just kind of my start of like, I don't care what anybody else thinks. Like, I'm going to have fun with this. I mean, you see these pictures that are put up on the wall, every like dressing room, and they all look the same, and you just can't, like, who cares? You know, it's a picture. Everybody wants one picture at the end, and it's a Stanley Cup picture. That's the only one anyone cares about. I never seen anybody put up a picture of a team picture.
Of a team, I know.
I don't know. So I was like, you know, I'm gonna just poof my hair up, and I put it right up there, and it stays frizzy. And I don't know. I just went out there, and guys started laughing, and management didn't seem to have a problem with it. So I was like, all right, I'm gonna roll with it.
Yeah, it's liberating when you get to that point where you realize you don't have to give a shit what other people think. I mentioned the crossword puzzles earlier. I was dead serious. Like late in your career when you're doing them in the locker room, did any of the younger kids actually come up and ask, what are you doing? Like having no clue because they're so not as common as they used to be?
Yeah, I mean, we have there's some people just gravitate over to it slowly and be like, oh, what are you doing there? And then the next day they're kind of like, let me try and get one. And then they just kind of just slowly inch their way in. And then eventually they get too good. They're like, hey, I'm like, hey, get your own crossword now. Okay. But I love doing them when I was younger. You know, Eric Cole's one. He used to do them all the time with me, and Matt Cullen did them a lot. And I kind of just got it off that. And I don't know. It keeps the mind sharp.
I did one time because Scuderi did them every morning and a bunch of other players did it. They had their coffee and they had to fold it up USA Today, something to do, you know, this before the online bullshit. And I said, I'm going to do one, enough of this shit. And I grabbed a USA Today one and I looked at it for 10 minutes and I couldn't get one right.
Not one.
Not even a USA Today clue.
Not even one that
put
was
the
three
thing
letters.
Down, but it was Friday. I remember it was a Friday in which I found out later is the hardest one. Where it goes Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Friday's the hardest. So I just grabbed it on Friday, got the pen, got my coffee filled with sugar and like whole milk for my pregame drink. And then I tried doing it and I didn't get one word, and I've never looked at a crossword puzzle since.
Let me ask you this. Sudoku, better? Are you way better with the numbers?
No, I'm not. Are you a numbers guy? I'm not good at them.
Yeah, well, I what's the math guy? I was
think
asking.
I invented that game.
Well, who's stat guy? Somebody's stat guy on this. Who's stat guy?
Witt. I don't know. Me and Witt have been sharing the title lately.
Biz has been stealing some of mine.
Hey, do you listen to the pod frequently?
Yeah, I do. I'm probably the last 6-7 months or so. I've kind of gotten to, like, my son's like he's really pumped on this. Like, he's upstairs right now. He can't believe that I'm doing the podcast with you guys.
Go
he's
buy him a awesome. Crate of Pink Whitney, please,
he's
with all
so
that fucking money you made.
Yeah, he's so looking forward to it. But I got to tell him, like, you know, this is like locker room talk a little bit. And, you know, you have to have the talk with him when he gets into the locker room, too. Like, you don't repeat any of this, especially to your mother. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, he's kind of at that
this
age.
This guy stuff.
Yeah, it's just guy stuff. We're just messing around. Normal people don't really talk like this, right?
You gotta tell him. You gotta tell him you're gonna video one of his swings into the 18th hole of Pebble Beach behind you into the simulator, and say we'll send it into Chicklets to get it on their Instagram. 800,000 followers. We'll see how his swing is under pressure.
Hey, we should do a par three. Let's see how close he can get it to the pin. Can you go set that up right now?
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Let's go. We're challenging you. But the last thing I was going to ask you, considering you listen to the podcast, you must have heard one of your former teammates, Todd Fedoruk, come on. I know you guys had a great bond, and I'm sure he is a treat.
The guy I compare him to is like Chris Farley. I mean, he is the funniest guy. He's got that chubby face, and he's just like, he's the life of the party, right? And he did the best like Hitchcock impersonations I've ever seen in my life. The guys would set the stage for him and be like, Friggy, do it. And he'd come in and do it. And he was just so funny. Like I have so much respect for like what he's gone through and you know, the whole addiction thing. I love hearing stories of success like that, guys who have battled through those types of things and kind of just meet it head on and say, I'm going to deal with this. And you know, when I came, like he was, I'd never seen him when he was, you know, off the rails a little bit. You know, when I came in, he was 21 years old and sober as heck, but he still liked to go out and, you know, to the bars, and he still wanted to come out all the time. And I remember this one time, like he lived down the street from me, and I was actually sitting on the couch with a girl who's actually now my wife, Kelly. And he had texted me earlier. He's like, "Hey, we're going out tonight." And I was like, "I'm not really feeling it. You know, maybe tomorrow." And so the night went on, and he texted me. He's like, "I'm coming over," and I didn't respond. And then I'm sitting watching a movie, and the doorbell rings. I'm like, "Oh no." I'm like, "No, don't answer. Don't answer, because we're not answering the door." So he rings it for a little bit. You know, you kind of hear him outside. "Willie, I know you're in there." And so I still don't answer the door. And so a couple minutes goes by, and I'm like, "All right, he's gone." And I go, we're watching the movie, and in my back door, I can see it's a big, like, you know, it's the door that opens up, and you can see through it. And I see this big shadow come right next to where the TV is, where I'm watching the movie, and he's, "Willie, open the door." And I'm like, "Oh my God." So I opened the door, and he ended up getting me out. But I have so much time for that guy. He was great with me, and still one of my great friends.
All right, good stall. Let's hear, or let's see this shot now. Let's see how close you can put it to the pin.
Who, me? Me or yeah. My son?
Oh, I thought Witt was asking for you to hit it. Witt, or do you want his kid?
Oh, No, the only reason I thought his son, was all nervous that he was on there, and I was going to say, go grab him and fucking have him tee one up, see how he does under pressure.
Okay, all right.
We could.
What are you doing?
Or you could just do it and send us the video, and we'll post it.
All right. I'll do that. What a hole.
Hey, this is an awesome interview. I've really enjoyed chatting it up. I don't think we've ever really actually met, besides playing against each other. Golf-wise, you got a bunch of trips you got planned. I know COVID fucking kind of screws everything over, but where are you going to be playing at mostly?
Yeah, I'm here in Raleigh, and I'm playing quite a bit right now.
Where'd you join?
I'm at this place called Old Chatham.
Oh, I heard that's sick.
It's nice. It's beautiful. It's like, you know, it's an hour from Pinehurst, and I can head down and play the Pinehurst courses. And yeah. But I don't really go stray too far from there. Yeah, I live on a golf course, but I don't play here that often. Old Chatham's just kind of where I go. But I don't have any golf trips planned either.
I want to go to Bandon.
So do I. You want to do it? I'd love to.
We should do it. We should get a group of eight together. Go to Bandon Dunes, man. It's such a hike for us, though. What?
That's such a hike for the West East Coasters.
I know it is. It is. But you just fly into LA and then you get a jet up to Bandon.
What big swinging dick are you playing golf with? I'm not paying for that.
All right. Well, we appreciate it so much. Unbelievable career. You did it all, and you did it all with class and passion, and it was pretty cool to watch. So thanks for joining us on the show. And we really appreciate it. And we want a video of your son's big swing. It's going to get on the Chicklets Instagram.
All right, what hole you want me to post here?
The par three on at Pebble, number what is it, six?
Yeah, the one downhill there, like the 100-yard one.
Yeah, let's see how he does on that one.
All right, man.
Huge thanks to Justin Williams for joining us. He definitely raised the collective IQ of the show when he comes on. He's a smart guy. Been around the league a bunch, and hopefully the next stop for him will be the Hall of Fame. I think he'd be a great broadcaster too if he's so inclined. But either way, Justin, enjoy retirement. You certainly earned it. Okay, moving right along.
With golf season in full swing, Chevy wants to help you make the most of every drive, and the all-electric Blazer EV's bold design and dynamic performance make it the perfect electric vehicle to get you to the course in style and comfort. Chevrolet, together let's drive.
All right, gang, next up on the show is the host of Family Feud Canada, the very funny Jerry D. I just want to let you know there were some cell phone issues when we did the interview, so we did have to cut some of it. I think we might have been missing a thing or two. So without further ado, enjoy Jerry D. Well, our next guest is a guy who has had Canada in stitches for the last two decades, a teacher turned actor comedian. He's the creator, writer, and star of Mr. D, which ran for 8 seasons on CBC. He's performed at the world-renowned Just for Last Festival in Montreal and appeared on Last Comic Standing here in the States a couple times. You've also seen his sports reporter segments on The Score. He's currently the host of Canada's version of one of the most famous game shows ever, Family Feud. It's an absolute pleasure to welcome to the show, Jerry D.
Oh, that was really nice. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for joining us.
RA is the most professional at giving introductions.
Awesome.
It makes you sound like a true legend.
Yeah, I love it. Thank you.
How you liking the feud, man? You just started that recently, right?
Yeah, it's a lot. I was a little nervous, right? It's like you said, it's been around for 40 years. Steve Harvey's like a legend now on that show. So I knew I'd get compared right away, and, you know, that's part of it. But I found my footing, I guess, maybe three quarters of the way through and started to get more comfortable. But it's a lot of fun. It's something I didn't ever see me doing. So it kind of turned into something real nice.
Which version of the feud did you grow up watching? There've been, you know, half a dozen of them.
Yeah. Well, I started with Richard Dawson, and then I went to Ray Coombs, and then I left it for a bit. I remember Louis Anderson did it a couple times.
I got a question about that game, because we just recently took part in a Barstool Sports version of the game. It was with another podcast that some football guys have, Busting with the Boys, and we didn't really get a chance because the other team, boom, boom, boom. If they get them all, like, you can go to the show and not even really have a chance to even give an answer.
Yeah, you get that. I get families. If you're in that fifth spot, which is the weak spot, like, if you're told when your family's on, you're in the fifth, you're like, they're telling you, you're not good. And then you don't even meet that person sometimes. So this guy or girl just stands there the whole show, and then the other team wins so fast. See you later, buddy. Like, that's it.
Who are they interviewing for these questions? Who's answering them? Do you know the answer to that?
It's like a service that I don't know how they do it in the States, but in Canada, I guess it's a company or service that they're legit surveys. They go across the country, and those numbers you come up with. I mean, I'm not part of that. So, but yeah, it's all. One thing I know is it's a real strict game. Like, if I make one mistake or fumble the question, they chuck it and we do it again because it might not have been fair. And there's a lot of rules. So they're pretty strict about everything.
Corporate bullshit. Good. You could call it what it is. Tell them to fuck off. No, right now.
Kind of I'm Jerry D, bitch.
It's good to be by the rules, man. You got to – otherwise everybody's all over the place. So it's a strong format. It's been around for a while, and they know what they're doing. I just do as I'm told.
Did Terry Ryan one time open for you?
Yeah. So, well, Terry's a funny guy, as we know. But what happened was, I got a tweet, and someone said, "Get Terry Ryan on the show." And I don't even know who he is at the time, right? So I'm like, as if that's how it works, right? You just tweet me. And I'm like, okay, sure.
Yeah, come on down.
This guy on the show. But then a guy I knew, a hockey player, texted me, and he's like, you should get Terry Ryan on the show. So I'm like, who is he? I got the story. So I phoned up Terry. The show was kind of done at that point. And we started talking, and I read his book, and I had this idea to come open for me because I was doing these, like, arenas in Canada for the first time. And then I had to stop doing them because I couldn't fill half of them. So it was, but I did this. It was like my biggest show ever. I said, listen, do you want to open for me and tell those stories? We were the Oshawa Generals play. And I'm like, it's a perfect fit, right? You played in the NHL. You got this story. And he did a great job. I mean, it's like, it still was his first time, but man, that's hard to do. Go up. It was 3,500 people. And he told his story about, typical when you're a fourth liner and then you got tapped on the shoulder, but his skates were undone because he was getting skate bite and he had to tie him up and then he fell and, you know, but he just told stories and people love those stories. So real hockey town. And then he did a couple more for me. I went to St. John's and I went out with him after and his buddies from Newfoundland, just a good guy, like a good, you know, out east guy. And we had he did a great job. It was interesting though, but he had the balls to do it. You know, Terry, like, he'll do anything, right? So I give him credit.
That's what we talked about recently on one of the podcasts, just even having the jam to go up there and with no experience, Terry just gets on up. He's a trooper. Many ways Canadians may know you. I first saw you when you were doing with the interviews with the NHLers and you were just fucking with guys. Now, like, content and all this internet stuff, it wasn't around. So if you weren't seeing it really on television, you know, you didn't see it at all. So did some guys you were fucking around with, they not know the shtick, and were they getting pissed off?
Yeah.
I always saw the positive ones.
Yeah. No, well, there's a couple, like, so eventually what happened was, like, my very first one was mass staging. So, and I wasn't known, right? So I went in, I'm dressed like a reporter. I got the mic from the Score, which is a known sports station. And I told them, hey, man, you know, Jerry D from the Score. And, you know, you know, Paul, you just, you're like, yeah, whatever. Yeah, I'm happy to do this. You stand by your stall. And I said, look, I put the wrong lens. So we got to stand kind of close, but it's going to look normal on TV. So by the 20 seconds of the interview, I'm cheek to cheek to him. And he's not comfortable, right? But he's, you know, I got the Nomad after this, and he's really uncomfortable. And then I went across the room, and I can't remember this guy's name, but he had a really long name. And I kept looking up at his stall to see who he was. So I sat here and I look up. No, it was a guy from Chicago. Oh, yeah. He has a brother that played long. Wisniewski?
No, Van Riemsdyk.
No, it was Wisniewski. It was a guy named Wisniewski or something.
All right. Yeah, anyway, ironically enough.
I had a good guess.
Ironically enough, we're actually interviewing him tonight after you. So
no fucking way.
No, you're not.
Yes, yeah. You're not.
Are you?
Swear to God.
Which one, though?
James Wisniewski on the Chicago Blackhawks, yeah. You're saying, right?
Yeah, I think it's his brother that I had.
Andy, there was like an Andy Wisniewski or whatever. We're just dropping names right now. I interrupted your story. I apologize. You can go ahead.
No, it's okay. So but it was basically what I did. I go to these guys and I would mess with them. But the one that never worked, that I had to bail, because you have to commit to the character. But once I got to the American players, once I got known in Canada, because it was on in Canada, but the American players never knew me. So I went up to Chelios, and he was 46. I'm like, why are you in the minors at 46? Chris Chelios. So I went up to him. I said, hey, Chris, Jared E. from the Score. He's like, what's up, man? I listen, man, this has got to be exciting for you. 46 years old. You finally called up. You finally get your chance. You know, that's got to be – you waited a long time. And he's like, what the fuck are you talking about? I'm like – well, it's just you're playing in Atlanta a couple of days ago. Here you are, up in, you know, he wasn't in Atlanta, he's in Atlanta's farm team. Here you are, you're playing for Atlanta tonight. And he's like, dude, are you serious, man? So he never got it. So I just slowly bailed out of it because I'm like, this guy's not getting the joke here. That was the only
he's going to end up drilling me.
Like, were you ever able to get somebody maybe outside the hockey world or someone who was like an A-list celebrity?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did. I'm going on a blank here on this actor, but I got one of the Entourage guys, Kevin Costner. Kevin Costner was in a golf tournament, and he was trying to chirp me a little bit. No, yeah, from Tin Cup. He was trying to chirp me a little bit. And, I mean, I'm pretty good at that. I do it on stage. You know, it's my life, right? So we had a good I just kind of chirped him back, but he was good about it. Like, it was fine. There's been I did like a couple hundred of those. There was, I remember I had Damon Allen's brother, Marcus Allen, who was like, you know, Hall of Fame football player.
Oh, yeah.
And Damon Allen is a Canadian football star, and I would just pretend he was Damon Allen's brother. Like, this is so cool. I'm like, did you play sports too with your brother? And he's like, what? I'm like, did you play any sports growing up? And Charles Barkley was the best one, I think, because, you know, he didn't know me, but he was so good in the interview, and we were betting on things, and then he wanted to bet on something else. I'm like, you got a gambling problem, man, and which was kind of timely at the time. He's like, it's not a problem if you have the money to lose it. And then,
but he didn't.
He was good. He was probably the most prominent one that I had was Barkley that got the most attention. But you're right, Paul. They weren't on the internet. You didn't really see them unless you watched it.
So, Jerry, you were a teacher before you became a comedian. How do you make that transition? How does that come about?
Yeah, it was a slow transition. It was starting to just, you know, I was kind of funny with my buddies, kind of, but not thinking I'll be a stand-up. And then I was funny as a teacher, and it was actually a student in my grade 12 class that kind of had said at one point, you ever thought of stand-up? And then
no
I had a
shit,
buddy
huh?
I was
no
waiting
way.
With, and I just,
wow.
Yeah. It just kind of kept coming at me. A guy I was working with at a restaurant was a comic, and then I just said, yeah, I should try it, man, because I knew there was something there, but it's hard to admit you're funny, right? No one wants to go, yeah, I'm funny. Like, usually those people aren't funny. Yeah, I'm really funny. Like, who does that?
So great point. That's a great point.
Yeah, right? So I just slowly sort of drifted into it, and then I finally left teaching 5 years into it.
I can't believe a student actually said that to you, because I was thinking, if you can make a high school class laugh, that's when you know you're funny.
Yeah.
Because they're not laughing at anything an adult's saying. They're sick and tired of you. So that's pretty funny that you got into it that way. What about like nerves? We've asked a bunch of different people, and some people say they get really nervous each time, and some people say they don't. Are you somebody that beforehand you're kind of like panicking, or is it just, here we go?
No, and you're right. Like, even I've opened for guys way bigger than me, and they're nervous. And I'm like, how are you nervous? You're a friggin' star. But I got, you know, when I started, yeah, it was like my first time on stage. There's nothing harder I've ever done. Like, it was terrifying. And I bombed, and people are like, get
off. First time?
And it's, yeah, a lot of times, man. Like, the first 5 years are really, like, you take an 80 gig you can get, right? Like 20, you know, 50 bucks, you're like, stage time, perfect. And I did this gig, and it was out in, you know, a smaller town. It was a guy's night out. They'd done it for years. It was 250 guys. They had a big meal, and they're like, we have a comic. And I'm not a real dirty comic, so I'm like, I don't care, I'm getting paid, I'm getting stage time. I didn't know this. They had two strippers on after me. So I find out when I get there, they came in. So once you're done, strippers come on. I'm like, strippers? So, like, you know, 5 minutes in, I got to do 45 minutes. All I'm hearing is, bring on the stripper for 45 minutes. So then I don't know where to go. I'm still new. I start ripping the strippers. Like, I start carving the strippers. Cause I'm all alone up there. Now I'm just bombing, and the strippers aren't happy. So it was
– the morale was very low.
You
ruined
this whole thing.
Oh, that's not bombing. That's just sucking the energy right out of
me. Great job. Who's this Jerry D guy? Fuck.
Who brings strippers on after? Put them on first. But if they put them on first, the guy just left. You get gigs like that, though. Horrible gigs. I had a gig, and my best gig after last comic, I get a new agent. He calls me up. He goes, I got you a gig in the Bahamas. It pays me like 50 times what I've ever made, right? Like, I'm like, oh my God, this is what last comic did, right? So I go to this gig, and we're on this island in the Bahamas, and I'm with, it's a marlin fishing trip. And I'm looking out in the ocean, there's like 50, $30 million yachts. And then they fish all day, and then they come in, I'm the comedian. And the guy's like, now they all have their nieces. I'm like, their nieces? Well, the nieces, I didn't know the nieces were prostitutes. So it's these 70-year-old men with fathers and me trying to do well. I was a teacher, and they're like drunk as hell, and they slowly just start leaving this room. And I'm slowly just dwindling down, just me and five waiters by the end of it, because they're all going home with the nieces, right? Now I'm stuck on the island, so I can't lose these people for the whole day. And they're like, hey, there's I bombed. It was terrible. But I know I got to do the 45 minutes, right, or I won't get paid. So I'm just sweating up there. I'm like, this is what last comic got me? This isn't fun. Nieces. This is the first time I heard that term.
I was going to ask you about you as a hockey coach, but I kind of want to know some more bombing or weird comedian stories. Do you have any more in that vault or no?
Oh, my God. There's a lot of bombing.
Was that the weirdest scenario you've ever found yourself in?
The first one was that was the worst. That was the most. I was like, this is horrible. Like, the most I bombed. You know, you come off last comic, you think you're a rock star, and then go to this, and I'm bombing. I'm like, what am I getting out of this? But I did one in a tent of mosquitoes, in northern BC. I'm like, this is awful. Like, I couldn't even. There was like hundreds of mosquitoes, and there's like 60 people. So there's more mosquitoes than people, and I got to get through 45. Like, there's nothing. It's hard enough as it is, and you get bitten, and you just going by your ear, zooming by your ear, and they're just used to it, right? That was bad. I'd have to think, but there's been a lot of.
How much of that 45 minutes were you spending, like, swatting away flies? And did you eventually make it into your material, just talking about these fucking flies?
Well, you can't really. It's hard to flow, right? When you're getting bitten and there's one in your ear, and you're like, oh my god, how do you guys do it? Like, it's not going to be a good set, right? You're bombing the whole time because you can't really get in. You forget where you were. You're like, sorry, man, it's got one in my ass, I think. You can't really focus. You can't lose your train of thought when you're a comedian. But there's a lot of stories. I just had one I was going to tell you that I just lost my mind. But there's a lot of those that you get in your years.
I'm going to need you to find that story for us.
Biz is going to haunt you down for that story.
I'm going to need that one, buddy.
There's a great story I had where it was actually that Remick event where Walter Gretzky, this was my best line, I think. Walter Gretzky gets up and it's about 10 years ago. So I get picked up at the airport and it's me and Walter, right? And I've never met him. And so he's telling me jokes all the way, 45 minutes from Halifax airport. So he's telling me jokes. I'm like, this is tough, man, because this is what I do for a living. I can't tell my dude for a living. Yeah. So he's got, you know, the dad jokes, right? But it's Walter Gretzky. So you get to the gig, and there's 1,000 people there. It's $1,000 a plate, black tie dinner, big fundraiser. And there's Mickey Ward was on the stage. I sat next to Mickey Ward. Roberto Alomar was there. It was like a real list of celebrities. And I was the comic, right? I wasn't really known or anything. So Walter gets up first, talks about, you know, I put water on the grass. I remember him saying, I used to just put water on the grass in the winter and it would freeze and Wayne would go out there and I'd go in and have some beers and he gets a standing ovation. Like he tells this story about it. He gets a standing ovation. And the next guy going up is Anthony Calvillo, who just won the Grey Cup with cancer. With cancer. He has cancer and he tells it at the end of the game. He wins the Grey Cup and no standing ovation. So, of course, I call it, right? I'm like, what's going on here? This guy sprinkled water on the grass and his son's, and he's drinking beers and watching hockey, and this guy's beating cancer. And, you know, to chirp Walter Gretzky was, he just didn't do that, right? But I don't even know if he knew what was going on at the time because he was just kind of back there, you know. But he was a good sport. I don't know how he took it. The best one I ever had was Gordon Lightfoot, where I did a gig with him and, you know, he comes in and he's a legend, right? And I'm like, that's wow. Like, he didn't look great. I'm not going to lie. Like, I think he's had, he's had some fun. So this is about 6 years ago and he comes in and he does not sound great. And I'm like, but it's Gordon Lightfoot, right? He's in a room. It's not the best sound, but it's still Gordon Lightfoot, a legend. But then he says he's doing a 42 city tour. At the end, he goes, thanks everybody. Just about to go on a 42 city tour. So if you want to grab some tickets. So I get up right after. I said, listen, if you got tickets for the 42nd tour date, you may not be going. I'd be checking to see if that show's still on because he did not look good. And I don't even know what he said. You can't wait as a comedian and worry. Am I going to offend anyone? You know, it's kind of just humor, but yeah, that was a little riskier.
Did you glance over what you said about Walter?
Did I what?
Did you glance over what you said
about... No, he chirped the fact that he got a standing O in the guy who had cancer and won the Grey Cup.
I thought maybe there was another one. Well, no, I was wondering if there was more than that.
No, it was just about the standing ovation with Walter going like, I was just kind of chirping the fact that we're...
All right.
Like, he's not Wayne. Like, I'm telling the crowd, that's not Wayne. You know that, right? That's the dad.
That's so there was more. So there was more.
The lawn.
There you go.
Yeah.
You did. You got it, Biz.
Hey, can you kindly tell Witt to shut the fuck up? Because I knew there was more, and I asked about it.
You didn't think you thought he glazed over some stuff?
I wanted to know what the jokes were.
Good ending.
Right. I want to know what the joke is.
Well, yeah, I guess I didn't flush it out. Yeah, you're right.
Because I could picture you up there just constantly saying that over and over and pointing to the back of the stage.
I remember Mickey Ward saying to me after, oh, man, I was scared shit what you were going to say about me. I'm like, hey, I'm not going to mess around with you, buddy. It's a little different. Walter, Mickey Ward, a little different.
Yeah, sick as crazy brother on you instead of doing it himself.
Yeah. That's right.
Jerry, there's such a rich comedy tradition in Canada. What, like, which performers had an influence on your comedy and the way you, you know, what shaped you as a comedian?
Yeah, like, my biggest idol growing up was John Candy, but I never planned on being a comedian, right? Like, I was a teacher for 10 years. This happened at 30. You don't start stand-up at 30.
Right.
That's like saying I'm going to, you know, be an NHL hockey player, and you start skating at 14 going, I'm going to try to get NHL. Like, I guess it could happen, but I don't know. I mean, it might not be a great analogy, but John Candy I loved. Michael J. Fox I loved. That's who I grew up with. John Ritter. That was just guys I watched and looked at and laughed. And my dad was really funny. My parents were from Scotland. My dad had this really funny Scottish humor. And I don't know, I just kind of fell into it. I mean, I'm glad I did it. I never thought I would do it, though. It was never a plan.
A little similar to Michael Myers then, growing up around the Toronto area, having Scottish dad. Did you ever meet him?
Yeah, Mike Myers' dad was actually English.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. That's right.
I don't know where he gets. No, but I don't know. But he does a good Scottish, and you know, that's that bastard stuff he did was, you know, that was real. That's real, real. So he had someone Scottish, but I think his father was English. But yeah, he was another guy. I was a bit older when he came onto the scene, but yeah, there's another guy that I looked up to and legend in Canada. You know, there's a bunch of guys like that, but I never followed stand up. I didn't know who the stand-ups were. Like, Richard Pryor to me was an actor, and here I am. He's just, you know, didn't know who Lenny Bruce was. I didn't know who they were. Right. I didn't follow stand-up. I wasn't a guy that followed it or studied it.
So are you one of those diehard Toronto Maple Leafs fans that sits out in the square and watches the game on TV, like in the playoffs? Like, is that your team? Is that your club?
That's my team. Yeah, that's my club. What's your club?
What?
Boston?
What? My club? I don't really have one, actually. I just root for the guys I played with that made me money, and then my friends. I was a Bruins fan growing up, but I loved Yzerman, so I was just all over the map. But I didn't know, like, Toronto Maple Leafs fans are passionate. They don't like anyone else, usually, the ones I've come across.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they're usually not the ones in the building, because it's a real, you know, you ask the players, it's not, well, maybe not these, but it's not a fun building to play in. Like, it's kind of quiet, but I am a Leaf fan. I've grown up, you know, I lived in Toronto my whole life, but I'm not sitting outside, you know, watching it on the big screen. I don't get to as many games as I'd like to. But yeah, I'm a Leaf fan. But I'm also, because I got to know more guys, you know, like, that used to hate the Habs, but I've met a couple of guys on the Habs. So I'm not, you know, it's different now, right? Because I'm not going to rip the Habs, you know, or a team that so I just kind of keep quiet. And, you know, I Bruins fan, I did a show with Dennis Leary a couple months ago. And this is, you know how much he loves hockey. Like, this guy's a diehard Bruins fan. Like, he knows everything about them. I'm not like that with the Leafs, right? I don't know everything about them.
Before I ask you about coaching Max Domi and Stamkos and those guys, you're going back to your TV show. You had Nathan MacKinnon on and one other hockey player?
Yeah, Camilleri. Camilleri I knew from golf, and he did me a favor. Like, he was playing at Montreal at the time, and then he got traded. Was it Calgary? He got traded. So we had to re-edit the whole thing, because in the show we say, wow, is that you, Mike Camilleri from the Montreal Canadiens? So, but he was great. You know what I noticed about any of those guys, they just, no matter what they're doing, they want to be the best at it. They don't want to mess up. They take it real seriously. Like, it's, you could see why they're the best in the world at what, you know, all of you guys have played, why you're the best in the world at what you do. But MacKinnon was 16, so it was a little different. And he did it for 3 years. Not even that. He was just, I got him. I wouldn't get MacKinnon in his draft year. A guy tweeted same thing. You should get MacKinnon, because he lived in Halifax where we filmed. And I'm like, yeah, that'd be great. And then a guy named Cameron Critchlow, who played with MacKinnon in Halifax, he said, I'll get Nate and I'll do it. I said, done. And then Nate and he arranged it. So they did it. Then I said, you guys want to come back? They did it a second time. Do you want to come back? And the third time, he had been drafted first overall, and he came back, and that was it. I didn't even bother asking a fourth time, because it would have been overkill. But Great guy. Like, both of them just did a great job. It's not, you know, it, some guys can't do it. Camilleri and Nate and Cameron were good at it. They did a good job. It's not an easy transition.
Yeah, the name of the show, for our listeners unaware of it in America, is called Mr. D. It ran for 8 seasons up in Canada. So now you went from a teacher to a comedian slash actor. Now you were basically the showrunner. How exhausting and busy was it being a showrunner for Mr. D?
Yeah, it was. You know, I didn't know any better. Like, I felt like I won a contest. Like, I'm teaching, and then I'm a showrunner. I didn't know what the term was, but I had a lot of people around me helping. You know, yeah, showrunner, but there were others there that kind of were that. It wasn't like we had just me showrunning. There was a group. You know, my partner who did Trailer Park Boys, you probably know that show.
Yeah,
he was a big part of it. My writers were big. So it was more of a group effort than me just running around doing everything. Because, acting in it and show running it or whatever you want is a lot of work. But I didn't mind it. I was just happy to be there, man. I was like a kid in a candy store. I'm like, I can't believe this. I'm in a sitcom. And then I'm like, not only am I in it, it's one I picked someone. It was pretty cool.
How much of the television show was your real life when you were actually a teacher and your interaction with the students? Was it like 90%?
That's a great question, Paul. It was a lot the first 3 years. First 3 years was a lot of my real stories. And then and there's exaggeration, right? Like, you know, we had a scene that your American listeners would know is because we didn't take off in the States, but we had a scene that it was about little kids sitting around talking about prostitutes and crack whores. And if you watch that scene, you'll know it because it'll come across your Facebook or some point. But, you know, that was not based on my life, but a friend of mine, you know, you get teachers in the later seasons that tell you that, you know, tell you stories about, and then we exaggerate, we flush it out and make it, you know, like this story was about teaching little kids words. And then Owen, kid says prostitution. I'm like, oh my God. And what's prostitution? Okay, prostitution. I give this, you know, this happens in teaching. And then I'm like, okay, you know what? Let's do words that end in RE, but let me think for a second. And I'm like, okay, this is safe. And the kid goes, crack whore. And that's where you have to think. But that stuff is all real. That stuff goes on, right? And a lot of it happened to me in the early seasons. Like, you know, stories that we, you know, we had a boxing match season. And I fought a teacher. We had a real boxing match, so that was a real story, and it was awful. Like I killed. Like it was the most. I don't know how you guys fight. Like it was nuts. I was so exhausted.
Why I didn't
6 months? Yeah, is that right? it's a lot of it is based on real the early seasons, and then we got more teachers to give us stories and built around it that way.
Now, I said you did it for 8 seasons. How do you come to the decision? We're going to cut it off here. Was it like we're going to quit kind of while we're on top before we kind of start fizzing out?
Yeah.
I wonder how that process goes.
Well, it's individual for everyone. For me, I'm like, okay, I don't know. Were they going to give us a ninth? I don't know. It was getting to that point where they may not have, but I thought I'd rather go out on my terms. And creatively, you don't want to drive it into the ground, right? So I thought, you know, I think it's a good time to go out. And I had a couple other projects pending. They never became anything. So it's just the right time. But, yeah, everybody's different. I mean, usually you get canceled, right?
Right,
that's
right.
How it works most times, especially in comedy. You're canceled. So it's always nice to say we were never canceled. And I kind of knew that could be coming, too, I think. So I just thought. Plus, you know, we had to live in Halifax. My whole family was out. And I felt my kids were missing a bit of their, like, you know, growing up in their with their friends in Toronto, and so it was a bit of everything, really.
So, I'm curious because you talked about the times that so many failures on stage, and then you talk about how shows get canceled. That's what happens with comedians. Was that hard on you, or were you able to get over that easily enough? I mean, I would say now, looking at somebody like you, you can handle anything because of how many failures you've had. I mean, whether they're small or large, right? I mean, you must feel like you're invincible at this point.
No, I mean, it's a fair point because I tell people, like, most of my life in this business is no, and that's normal for anybody in this business. It's mostly no.
Yeah.
I'm not one to burn bridges, and I'm like, it's no. Like, and I think playing sports growing up where you get cut, and you just deal with it. Like, it's like, I got cut, you know, I played that 1 year university hockey and then I got cut, rightly so, but you know, what are you going to do? Right. So you learn that that's part of life. I played a lot of golf as a junior. I was a competitive golfer where you miss cuts by one stroke and you drive home. You think of where you could have made up one stroke to go to what you thought was, you know, big event. And so I think sports helped me just kind of be a bit thick skinned. And realize, like, yeah, what am I going to do? Like, they don't want my show. Like, since Mr. D, I've pitched it, like, a bunch of other shows that have all been turned down. You think the guy had 8 seasons, but it doesn't work that way in Canada. You know, if I'm in America, it's probably a little different. But here, we just don't have the you know, there's a lot of talent here, too, but there's not as many places to put stuff on. And so I'm back to the drawing board like anybody else, and you're no all the time. And you gotta swallow your pride with it, right? If you're a big baby, it won't carry you much further. And I think that's coming through just sports. Like, what are you gonna do? You got cut.
You gotta take your lickings, you know? Man. You gotta fucking land on your face. You gotta get up. You gotta brush it off. I love that fucking analogy, but not my own, like yours. So I wasn't pumping my own tire. Sorry.
No, but you guys would have gone through that playing, right?
Even post career now, like we're standing in there in the media too. So you got to take some lickings once in a while. But hey, we got to get to the hockey talk here because you know all the hockey boys, and you have a story about every one of them. Since we were talking about the Leafs, earlier, why don't we start with Ty Domi? Didn't you have like squash game against them or something for charity?
Yeah, there was So I knew Ty a little bit. So I used to run this hockey school in Toronto when I was focusing on my coaching. And that's where I met Max and PK and Steve Stamkos, and they were little kids. They were phenomenal, and I had nothing to do with where they're at. But they'd come to this camp. So I knew Ty then, and Ty was playing for the Leafs. So anyway, I get to this. There's this charity squash event, and I'm a pretty good squash player, right? So I'm like, yeah. So PK Subban's dad is running, and I knew him from when PK had come to the camps. And he was a principal, so, you know, an educator, great guy, and he's like, would you come do this? We're doing this urban squash thing we're trying to develop. I said, of course. So I went, and there was some singers and everything. So I draw, they play this, celebrities play each other, and I draw Ty. And I'm like, I'm gonna kill you, Ty. Like, how do you play squash? Like, you know, so we're just joking, right? And he's, you know, he's Ty, right? So he's pretty intense. Like, so I get out there, and I just drill him with the ball by mistake. And it's like, have you ever been hit by a squash ball? It hurts. And I just rip it and I hit him and I just freeze because I don't know. Like, I don't know him that well. And he's like, what the fuck? And he's just so mad. And he lifts up his shirt and there's this massive welt. And I'm like, I don't know what he's going to do. And he just kind of just didn't do anything really. And we kept playing. But for about 5 seconds, I just think he's going to come at me. And I don't know what I'm going to do here. I got a racket. That's not going to do anything. It's tied on me. The door's shut. If I'm thinking, can I get to the door quick? And it was 5 seconds. He just looked at me with his teeth like, I think he was trying to figure out if I did it on purpose. And then he just kind of, I don't know if he laughed. I forget. I was so scared. I was like, oh, thank God. After that, I was like, nice shot, Ty. Good shot, buddy. That was
a fellow you want chasing you around. I want to ask you, it meant you were a Leafs fan, a crazy scrap of back in the 80s. I don't know if you remember a guy named Paul Higgins. Does that ring a bell?
Oh, yeah. I coached with Paul.
Oh, you did?
I didn't even know that.
No, I didn't even know that, to be honest with you.
Yeah, yeah. So my first coaching job, so I graduate from university. I get my teaching degree. I start running a hockey program at the high school. And a guy comes to me and says, do you want to coach AAA with the coach? And I'm like, who's the coach? Paul Higgins. My brother played for the same junior. My brother played for Henry Carr, Paul. When you played for Welland, I don't know if they were around, but they had a pretty strong program. So Paul Higgins played for Henry Carr, so my brother knew him. So Higgins gets me on the bench. So I'm Paul Higgins' assistant coach in Young Nats minor hockey. And oh, my God. He's a great guy, but it was still Paul Higgins. Right? He was like, he's just beauty. He was just, I don't know how much he knew about coaching at the time. But, you know, I gave him a lot of respect. The guy played in the show and did what he did, but he was another level, right? Like, he was, I don't know if he was different level of tough, because I think he would just do about anything. But I don't remember his playing career as much as I remember Domi's, obviously.
We just had Brian Burke on recently, and you had an encounter with him at the NHL Awards.
Well, when I did the NHL Awards, I did the warm-up Like, I've always wanted to host it, right? And they don't even give me a sniff because it's usually an American. And so anyway, they get me 1 year to open to warm up the crowd, which is like the kiss of death, right? Like, no one, people are coming in. I'm, hey, how you doing? It's like no one's listening. But I don't know. I was talking about Sean Avery. I was talking about Ovechkin when he scored, when he did the hot stick, and I was chirping him for the hot stick. And I was chirping Avery when I think he stood in front of Brodeur. I think it was that time. I forget. Anyway, I did a bunch of stuff, and Burke came up to me after. He goes, hey, man, you're really funny. And that's probably the only guy in the whole building that would have thought that because no one was even listening. So we kind of became friends through that. And then he was coming out to Halifax and we're filming. He goes, hey, you want to go out for dinner? I get texts from Berkey, right? It's just like, hey, how are you? It's like six months apart. How's it going? Just out of nowhere, right? So anyway, that all started from that. And he went out for dinner. And I'm like, God, I never realized. He was the GM at the Leafs at the time. And I was like, this guy is really smart. Like we just had dinner and all, you know, he was out there duck hunting. I'm like, are you serious? He goes, love it. Love it. Big duck hunter. I'm like, yeah, that doesn't interest me. So he didn't like that, right? But, you know, you know Berkey, right? He wears his heart on his sleeve, just does a lot of great things. So I've gotten to know him over the last 10 years. He comes to my shows once in a while. He's a straight shooter. He'll tell you, yeah, well, that wasn't your best set. That wasn't great. Like, whatever happens, happens, right? So good guy, and that's how we met at the NHL Awards. He came up to me.
Yeah, we just dropped our interview with him today. He's a great interview.
I
wanted to bring up you. You were in a docuseries about the 72 Summit Series on CBC
a few years back.
You played Wayne Cashman, who was one of the great players of that era, an absolute maniac. Did you get to meet him beforehand that like kind of helped prepare for the role? Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, no, I forgot about that. And that was my first acting role, and I only got it because I played a bit of hockey. So, you know, I didn't look like Cashman. I wasn't the size of Cashman. I didn't know who he was. So when I got there, you know, I found a way to reach out to him, to talk to him. And just so I never met him. He was living in Tampa. But we talked two or three times. Great guy. Really helpful. And he would say, yeah, that's bullshit. I never did that. Like, because, you know, you're portraying it. You know, you hear these stories that they were all these things going on. But he was great. I never got to meet him. We did. You know what? Sorry, I did meet him because we did a golf tournament after, and he was there. So there's about 26 of the guys at the golf tournament because some won't go, right? Like Bobby Clark has nothing to do with it. Ken Dryden, nothing to do with it. Like they're very – some of them are just not a part of it, and some of them are, right? And so at the golf tournament, there was maybe 26 of the guys or 18 of the guys, I forget. And their Hatfield was there. I sat next to Jean Rattel. I golfed with, he passed away. His son's on Minnesota. JP, what's his name?
Oh, Parise.
JP Parise. I golfed. He was who I golfed with. And, you know, we talked about his son, and he was at Shattuck St. Mary's when Crosby was there. So we were talking a bit about that. But it was great. You know, it was such a surreal thing for me to play in that series because, you know, For a month, I started believing I was in it. Like, you start to believe you're Cashman. It's getting a little carried away, right? Guys are calling
swinging
Cash.
The stick at people.
What's up? Yeah. What's up, Cash? I got it. That's how I got called. And the funny story there was the guy that played Esposito looked like Esposito but couldn't skate. Like, you don't hear that a lot in Canada. Like, zero ability. So he would go to these skating lessons. I'm like, guys, you can't teach a guy to skate in 6 weeks. Like, you just can't look at 35. You just not. He was a real confident guy, good actor, looked like Esposito, but hated the fact that, you know, couldn't skate. And he was, you know, he was the number one or two on the call sheet, which means he's up there. So the Globe and Mail, which is our national newspaper, does a story on the series coming out. And this guy was all about, like, getting noticed in the media. And, you know, he's talking about winning awards. I'm flying out with them, right? I never met him. Anyway, on the cover of our national newspaper, like, picture, like, your biggest new USA Today, on the cover is Esposito, hands in the air, but it's the stunt double. So this guy is fucking furious.
Zonk.
He's like furious. It's like, how the hell do you have the stunt double on the lead of the movie and you got the fucking stunt double on the cover? But it's like, yeah, you couldn't skate, man. Like, he just put his face up, and I'm like, dude, man, your stick's not facing the right way. Like, it was pretty funny. You look at Miracle on Ice. They went with hockey players, right?
Yeah.
You know, and then they thought, let's get guys that are hockey players, and then we'll get the acting down. And, you know, these guys that I became friends with, they, you know, we don't have the same resources in the States, but we had to get some guys that could act really well and look like the part, right? It's such an iconic series. You had to kind of look like the player. And you know, all the background guys, they were all like AHL guys. We filmed in the summer, you know. So I got to meet a lot of those guys. There was guys, one guy was like a heavyweight fighter in the AHL at the time. I can't remember his name. You know him. You guys would know him. But anyway, I sat on the bench and talked to him every take. Like, he just had so many great stories. So it was a real cool project. And, big, you know, it didn't take off here like I guess it could have, but they did a great job. I thought they did a good job of depicting how it went.
There's a few more stories I was supposed to ask you about. I guess to wrap it up, we'll let you pick one. The Yari Curry one or the Mike Gardner one?
Oh, the Mike Gardner one was funny for me because I get invited to this celebrity golf tournament. I'm like just headlining comedy clubs, not even close to being called a celebrity. And this guy, Andrew Jackson, did you know him? He does a lot of NHL guys. Anyway, he calls me, and we joke about it now, but he calls me to do this event. And I get invited. So these people are playing big money to get a celebrity. So Michael Burgess, who passed away, was the Phantom of the Opera. So he doesn't come. So they call me. They're desperate. It's the day of. You come be in a celebrity golfer. Someone gave him my name. I'm like, yeah, okay. I'm a comedian. I'm nobody. So I get there. My cart, my clubs go on a bag. I go to the putting green. I come back. My clubs are gone. So these people pay. They're like, who is this guy? We don't want this guy. So the guy says, no, you got moved over to this group. So then I go to my bag again. And then the next group, who is this guy? So they kick me off. So now I'm finally in my Gardner's group. But I know I'm supposed to be the celebrity, but I know he is, right? But I know I'm getting paid I was getting paid $1,000. And I'm like, okay, this is awkward because Mike's the celebrity. And then there's two other guys that paid to be with celebrities. So they just think I'm a lone guy that showed up by myself. So I get close to the pin on a hole. And I'm like, they're like, put your name down. But I know I can't. Ah, it's okay, man. Mike's like, put your name down. But I know I can't because celebrities can't put their name on that stuff, right? So we get to like the 16th hole, and then these two guys recognized me from Yuck Yucks, and they were like, oh my god, Jerry D, oh my god. They jump out of their cart, they're taking pictures, and Gardner and these other two guys have no idea what's going on, right? And when I had to explain to Gardner, I was also supposed to be the celebrity. Oof. But it was embarrassing through the whole round, right? To keep getting my clubs moved and everything, and it's like there's nothing more humidity.
You're getting pigeon tossed. Hey, but those are the lickings you need to take early on to get you to the top, man.
Yeah, and then the guy wouldn't pay me, and that's the best part of the story. The guy wouldn't pay me. He's like, "Look, man," I go, "Look, you know, can I get that money? I need it." I was like, just starting out, and he's like, "Look, man," and he's like, "Look, let's be honest, man. You're not a celebrity. This is the guy organizing it, right?" I go, look, I'm not on the phone. This is 2 weeks after. I'm not on the phone to debate whether I'm a celebrity. You hired me as a celebrity, or your associate did. Now you pay me as a celebrity. But I'll never forget him saying, look, you're not a celebrity. And then I had an event, the Conn Smythe dinner, a big event in Toronto. He was in the crowd, and I told that story because I was the headliner. Oh. I was the celebrity.
Whoa.
And he came up to me. Yeah, he came up to me, and he said, you know what? I deserve that.
Did you point him out in the crowd?
I just said his name. I go, oh, Andrew Jackson's here, yeah. And, you know, he give him credit. He came up to me and he's like, look, I deserve that. Because he said to me, look, man, you're not a celebrity. And now it's a different story for him. But, you know, he's a,
who's the singer, R.A.? The I could feel it falling.
Oh, Phil Collins?
That's a Phil Collins moment, is it not?
That's not a true story, though.
Yeah, that's a myth.
But Jerry, I'm the most gullible guy in the world. I'll believe anything you tell me.
Okay.
I always think everyone's telling me all the truth. And I'm like, oh, awesome, man. Fucking A. I'm the most gullible person.
Yeah, no. That was an interesting conversation, but I'll give him credit. He came up to me, said, "I deserve that. You're right. I said that, dumb," and we moved on from it.
Well, fucking rights, buddy.
Just get 700 goals. You'll be on the same level as him. That's all.
Yeah. Yari Curry was in Dubai. I did a gig in Dubai, and I was on Yari Curry's line, and I never saw the puck. It was him and his buddy from Finland. It was just funny because I just skated up and down for three periods at this free hockey game, and I did not get the puck. It was just Yari going back and forth with his buddy from Finland. But it was not a great story, but he was good. He was a good guy.
Nice. Well, hey, Jerry, we want to thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you and about your career. It's been a joy. And I'm gonna have to wire into Canadian TV so I can catch you on the feud now.
I love it. And don't you go up to Canada? Weren't you once?
We were up Lake Muskoka for the pond hockey tournament a couple months ago. That might have been that.
Did you ever go to Cabot Cliffs in Cape Breton, the golf course?
No, I've never been there. No, I'm not a golfer.
Worth checking out. But thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
Absolutely.
Love your podcast.
Thanks so much to Jerry for joining us and keeping Canada laughing during these trying times.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Speaking of drinking age, Thanksgiving is around the corner. G going to be having a couple glasses of vino, I'm sure. And it's a good time to remind people that Black Friday and Cyber Monday are coming soon with a bunch of new swag. What do we got, Mikey?
Tons and tons of new stuff, new golf stuff. We got some shower kits. I'm not going to tell everything that's coming out, but we've gone off the map. It's not just sweatshirts. It's not just t-shirts. We've got some crazy stuff coming. So very excited. So get to it, baby.
Absolutely. I'm sure they're following us on Twitter. They'll be hearing all about it. And now we're going to finish the show off with some final words from Ryan Whitney.
Thank you very much, RA. Guys, Whit here. Mikey, how are you? And I know people probably think, oh, Masters ended. He wants to talk. And I do. But if you really want to know why I'm truly buzzing as I've ever been in my life, it's because Monday at 7:44 a.m., my wife gave birth to our second son, Wyatt Tyler Whitney. Oh, I have the chills right now. My wife was an absolute legend, champion. It was a home birth. Incredible. We'll get into that in a second. But he is so awesome. He came out 7 pounds, 11 ounces, 21 and a half inches long. And yeah, it was nuts. So it was just amazing. And let me tell you, so it was at home because my wife wanted to do this with when she was pregnant with Ryder. I was like, nope, we're going to the hospital, you know, because I didn't know I wasn't educated. Then the more and more she talked about it, she's like, I really want to do it when we have another kid. I said, okay, all right. She explained to me. And then I started thinking, like, dude, people have been giving birth, you know, they were giving birth in caves. What is it? Is it millions of years ago people were on the earth, or maybe not?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Well, you know, whatever. I was down with it. But when the day came, Mikey, oh my God. I thought they'd be there and everything would go slow. Now, granted, my buddy, John Cronin, I was with him a couple days prior. He said he has three kids, three daughters. He said the second one, it comes way easier. It comes faster. Everything goes a little quicker. It's long labor with Ryder. Well, 6 a.m., she starts feeling like, you know, early labor. She's going, next thing you know, she is moaning, screaming in the shower. The midwives aren't there yet. I'm pacing. She saw me in the mirror later on. She told me, I thought I was delivering this baby. I'm like, this is not, I was getting ready. I was going to catch the baby. I legitimately was getting ready to give, to birth my own son. We didn't know at the time it was a boy. Well, she comes in bombing in. She's in the shower with her winter jacket on still. We had to get Bree to bed where she then at 7:44, like I said, an hour and a half after she first felt anything, maybe 2.5 hours. Everything's so, my brain's fried. Fathers, you know what I mean? Right now, the first 2 days after, you're on a different planet, Mikey. And yeah, everything went well. I never brought it up just because I was just keeping our privacy, I think. And I think it was also, we didn't tell anyone it was going to be a home birth because she didn't really want people to know that. I don't know why, but it was, thank God. All I said the whole time, people said, you want a boy or a girl? I just want a healthy baby. Like everyone knows, everyone who's had has kids understands. And thank God he's doing great. So it's been just an amazing couple days. Just this ultimate feeling of like, you can't love you. It's impossible to love someone this much. And like you almost forget it. Ryder's turning 3 in a month or in a week, excuse me. It's already getting forgotten about, but I wanted to share that. So that was unreal. Unreal. Like, I appreciated you reaching out, Mikey. That was great. And so thank you for listening to me explain about me now being the dad of 2 boys.
So how is Ryder handling it all?
Oh, he was furious. He wouldn't even look at Bree. The first day, he started realizing this kid's not going anywhere. Now, the next day, and like today, he's been good. He's been nice. Oh, the baby, Wyatt Whitney. And so he's gave him a kiss, and now things are good in that front. But God, he's still like, I don't understand. He hasn't left yet, guys. When's he leaving, Mom? So we'll see how it goes, but it's what a cool thing to get to grow up with a brother. I have 2 brothers myself, Colin and Sean. I'm the oldest, so nothing is better than having a brother. So I'm so fired up and really, really thankful, feeling blessed. It's crazy because the show, when this show started, Ryder wasn't even born. So it's been, so much has happened, and oh, I'm so thankful for all that's happened since I was done playing. I'm so lucky, and I think after your wife gives birth, you're so amazed at what she did, and you're also just thankful for what you have. So I wanted to share that. Now, we can talk about the Masters. I got a couple things quickly. I'll just quickly go through. Dustin Johnson. I think we have old clips, Mikey, of me talking. This is just the ultimate alpha. There's alphas and then there's DJ, the swag, the swing, the genius on a golf course. People say he's dumb. Now, granted, he gives some interviews where he either sounds like he A, doesn't give a fuck, or B, is really, really stupid. Maybe it's both, but this guy's a genius on the golf course. He's one of the greatest swings I've ever seen. He's so athletic, just beating it. And his brother at the end, he was getting emotional. He actually had to tell his brother. I read a little quote saying, hey, you gotta stop crying. I'm not gonna be able to, you're making me emotional. I gotta finish this tournament looking like DJ, stroking it in with a swagger walk that just looks, look, you belong in Hall of Fame, any sport you decided to play. So I was so fired up to see that guy win. How about that picture too? Tiger putting the jacket on you. That'll do. Yeah, the defending champ was Tiger Woods, and then I won. So 2-time major champion. Now, another couple things about that tournament. Bryson. Talk about an all-time backfire is to go into one of the most legendary, hallowed grounds of Augusta National, to go in there and say that the par is 67. Mike, I don't know if you know that. That means if he shot 20 under, he would have shot even par in his mind for the tournament. So, I mean, I think 20 under was the winning score. But Bryson just made a fool of himself. I've said many times I'm so impressed with this guy and his ability to change his body. And actually, he won the U.S. Open. I mean, this still is probably going to work. But he can't get out of his own way in terms of like public perception. Not that he cares, but we're talking heads, Mikey, so that's what we're supposed to do. He cannot get out of his own way. Whew. You can't come in and chirp a course like that. The golf gods out there, those guys have ears everywhere. You know about my hole in one. Now I'm never getting one. Another story, go back in time for that one. What else? Cam Smith, the Australian. This kid was straight money. I mean, he's just a gamer. I think he dusted Justin Thomas in a President's Cup match. That could be off. He played great. He's been there before. He's been at that highest level, but he didn't slow down once at Augusta. He was hitting his driver bad Sunday on 7 and on 9. He's ripping it right, just the club's late. And he's hitting these cuts out of the pine straw to 3 feet, tapping in birdies to stay in this tournament, stay with the opportunity to win a green jacket. You got to think that it might have been his best chance ever to win. That's the crazy thing about golf. All the studs, all these guys who just pound it. The guys who hit it like DJ, Rory. I mean, Rory's another story. Besides the first day, he could have won. But Cam Smith, he's not exactly a high-level elite ball striker. I don't think of him as one. Show me the stats. Maybe I'm wrong. But these guys who are pounding the ball, I think, you know, a guy like Cam Smith, I don't know if he'll ever be able to play that well at Augusta again. He was the first, actually, no chance he will. He's the first guy to ever, first and only guy, Mikey, to shoot in the 60s all four rounds at the Masters and win. So that's how hard it is, but the Masters is still great. I thought it was kind of cool without the fans. I missed the roars. I wanted the roars Sunday. I was sick of it by Saturday, but the first 2 days I really enjoyed. You get to see the whole course. I went down the year I retired. Oh my God, was it crazy down there? Just the slopes. You have no idea the undulation, how up and downhill everything is, but it's the craziest experience. No phone, $2 beers, whatever it was. I talked about it.
But beautiful foliage, too.
Oh, yeah. They put it, they probably had some orange and reddish trees planted in there. They buy, when they need to LinkedIn holes, they buy like, they'll buy like a school and knock it down. No, I'm just kidding. But you know, they'll seriously do whatever they can to just get what they need.
Did you see the bucket of balls getting sucked in under?
Oh, that was mesmerizing. I never seen that.
No, it's where crazy.
They have a couple little guys down there. They're shorter and they just have them running back and forth with Titleist, TaylorMade, Shrix on, whatever. What else was I going to say about the Masters? Oh, but the first few days of not having the fans, you saw so many different parts on TV that you'd never really seen before. You saw how the course plays a little bit different. And a lot of guys got screwed. Bryson lost that ball where he's like, so if we don't find it as a lost ball, he was actually close to getting a drop there. I know that's if there was water as he walked, Mikey, that came up, he would have got a drop. He would have been able to stay. All would have been able to agree that it went in there. But still, I was on edge because I also thought she was going to go into labor during the Masters. I'm like, not on the you know, I said, if this kid starts his journey out Sunday of the Masters during the back nine, it's a tough start. You know, if me and him are not getting off to a good start or her.
Or he's destined to be a golfer though.
No. I think he knew his dad wanted to watch. And instead he came the next morning. Like I said, 7:44, the greatest gift could ever receive. So shout out to everyone. I miss chatting. God, it's nice to just talk about things. The first episode when we're all really catching up again will be good. But this break's been awesome. I think Biz been on a hike, Mikey?
Yeah, he's hiking around Utah.
Oh, I didn't see any pictures. No, I'm just kidding, Biz. Those pictures were sick. I actually want to see the video. I saw it. He's also hanging out with Scotty Gomez right now, who we interviewed and probably could interview 19 more times because I think we just got through about his rookie year and it was an hour and a half. So Biz is getting it done for sure, as always. And RA is probably smoking a lot of drugs. But Mikey, we appreciate what you do. And obviously, I appreciate what all you guys do. So listeners, thank you so much. And we'll see you, in a couple weeks?
Yes, sir. First week of December.
All right, peace.
As always, we'd like to thank our awesome sponsors here on Spittin' Chiclets. Big thanks to our longtime friends at New Amsterdam Vodka and Pink Whitney. Big thanks to our friends over at NHTSA, keeping us safe on the roads. Huge thanks to our friends at Cross Country Mortgage. Hopefully, you're taking full advantage. And big thanks to all our friends up at Budweiser Canada. We continue. Have a great week, all.